The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
Dun, 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 dun. Chris Ryan, how are you, sir? Thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
Good.
I'm sorry if we allegedly got you too high before the show to talk.
Well, that long commercial gave me a chance to calm down a little bit.
That's what those are good for. Yeah. We stumble through those commercials. And it's sort of like when you have a car and it's a manual and it can't start, but you could push that bitch and then pop the clutch and it'll start. And then once it's going, you're okay.
Right.
That's what it's like. So the commercial acts as sort of like a scaffolding for us to get our sea legs under us before we venture out into the podcast world.
Right.
So thanks for doing this, man. Your book, if people don't know, it's called Sex at Dawn, and it was suggested to me by our very good friend Duncan Trussell. And I read it, and I fucking loved it, man. It's really, really interesting stuff. You know, I use one of the things that I read that I'd never heard before was the origins of the word Yucatan.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating stuff, man.
Yeah.
It was a misunderstanding, and that is it a Mayan person? I mean, who would you say?
Mayan. Yeah.
That what they were saying was essentially, I don't understand you. When they were asking, what is this place called?
Right.
They were saying, I don't understand you. Yeah. And that I don't understand you became, like, in a garbled sort of a way, what they described the area.
Exactly.
So describing it as, I don't understand you.
Yeah.
It's amazing because it sounds so authentic. If you say, well, we went camping in the Yucatan, it's like, you know, you sound like, you know, you're like fucking eating organic salads and doing the right thing.
Yeah,
and
you're out in nature.
But meanwhile, what you're at, I don't know, understand you. Yeah. That's where you are.
Yeah.
That is, in my opinion, like, if you look at the whole human race, that's a good example of, like, how screwball-y this whole system that we operate under is.
Good word for it.
You know, it's like, whoa, like, that's still the name. Like, it's still America. How about that?
Yeah.
You know, how about there are still Indians, you know? How about that's even more ridiculous? Yeah. We name ourselves after some dude that nobody knows. You're asking a kid who Amerigo Vespucci, is that what his name was?
Yeah.
That's the guy who America's named
after. Yeah, like, the only Italian who ever did anything in those days, you know? Other than write poems and shit.
Right.
But I mean, as far as exploring, you don't hear a lot about Italian explorers.
And we still celebrate Columbus Day, although it's incredibly clear now that Columbus was a huge asshole.
Do you know about Columbus? Talking about, like, original encounters, right? When Columbus first arrived in Hispaniola on the first trip, he wrote a letter back to the queen explaining what this place was like that he and his men had found, right? And it's amazing to read because the first 9 sentences are all about how great the people are, how they you know, if there's food, they share it without thinking. If you admire a piece of clothing, they give it to you without thinking. They're incredibly generous. They're incredibly healthy, beautiful, nicely formed bodies. They've got fruit in the trees and all the fish they could possibly want. He said, with 500 men, I could subjugate the entire island. Or however many, 200 or whatever it was. But it's just this whole litany of how wonderful these people are. In fact, it's even thought by some historians that the reason the people are called Indians is not this whole thing about Columbus thinking he was going to India, right? It's actually that in this document that I'm describing to you, Columbus wrote, seguramente es gente que viven en Dios, which means these are certainly people who live in God.
Oh.
Indios. And in Spanish, they're still called Indios.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy, huh?
Wow.
I mean, we came so close. He could have just said, fuck Europe.
Yeah.
Let's stay here. Right? Which other people did. Other explorers did do.
It's very difficult when someone's a cunt to turn them around. And it's very difficult when that's the culturally accepted way to live. What is that noise, man? Are you playing like shaman's shit in the background, dude?
It's I thought it was crickets.
Did you even know you were doing that? That
wasn't
on purpose, was it?
It turned on by itself. I think like it's on a. It was playing the. Never mind. Stupid stuff.
You got bugs in your computer, literally.
Yeah, that sounded like there was some dude in the background with like a rattle.
Yeah,
maybe dancing in some way. Maybe trying to bring back the old days.
It was the Joe Rogan theme on repeat in the background, turned down super low.
It would be so difficult when you grow up in the environment of the 1400s in Europe, which was just chaos and disease and war and yeah. famine and, you know, all these goddamn problems. And then to, like, abandon that once you got here, I think they probably couldn't do it. I think they were just so yeah. fucked up. And then all the also, like, desperado from a couple of months in a boat on the ocean, you know, that's got to drive you fucking squirrely.
Yeah.
Your feelings about human life have to erode. I mean, they have to.
Yeah.
Your appreciation for human life has to erode. It's like really worst case scenario. You take the craziest fucks you can find, people that are willing to get on a floating piece of wood, and you're going to push yeah. it out into this never-ending ocean.
Yeah.
And it might take a few months, and some of you are going to die.
Yeah.
Who's in?
Yeah.
Who's
exactly.
in?
There's a self-selection mechanism at work there. You ever seen the Herzog film, Aguirre, The Wrath of God?
No.
You got to see that, man.
What is that about?
It's about the conquistadors in Brazil. And it's the main lead role is played by Klaus Kinski, who is this super intense dude. Actually, Mick Jagger was supposed to play the role, but he got sick or he had a concert or there was some delay. He couldn't do it, so they brought in Kinski.
How many movies has Mick Jagger done?
I know of that one and one
choice.
Other one.
Yeah?
Yeah. No, Mick Jagger was the first choice.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's
I love that shit. I mean, that's a great movie. But what was the other one? Do you know who was supposed to play Hannibal Lecter?
Who?
Was first offered the role and turned it down?
Keith Richards.
Jack Nicholson.
Whoa.
Imagine that role with Jack Nicholson. I mean, it would have been different. It would have been great, but very different.
Yeah, it probably would have been equally great. Just different.
I think so,
just
yeah.
in a different way, you know? And, you know, people would go crazy. No, it must be Anthony Hopkins. Like, relax. No, it must not be.
You know, when Nicholson first came to Hollywood, he was a screenwriter. He wasn't an actor.
Really?
Yeah, and he was living with this dude who was an actor, or trying to be an actor. They were sharing a room somewhere or a place somewhere. And the story, as it was told to me, was that Nicholson was so unsuccessful selling stuff that he was ready to go back to Kansas or wherever the fuck he was from. Kansas, I think. And his friend said, just come to this audition with me, man. Maybe you'll get an extra role or something, just some money. So he read for the role, and the producer said, Mr. Nicholson, we don't need you for this, but if we ever need you, we'll need you very much.
Hmm.
You think about that in terms of Nicholson. He's always Nicholson.
Right.
You know, he's always Jack. He can't be anything
Jack.
Other than Jack.
Yeah,
there's an issue with guys that get to a certain role, like a part, like sort of like a characteristic role, like Al Pacino. Like he
right.
always has to yell now.
Yeah.
He's in like, he's yeah. always got to have a big rant! A big rant!
Preferably blind.
Yeah, screaming. Yeah. You know, like when he played the devil, that dude jumped a shark. Remember when he played the devil? Was it a Keanu Reeves movie? Did you remember
Devil's
that?
Advocate?
Is that what it was? Yeah, he played the devil. I'm like, listen, the devil would not be so fucking verbose. The devil wouldn't be screaming at you.
The devil's quiet.
The devil wouldn't even be emotional.
Silent,
you don't understand.
But
you don't understand
yeah.
what real torture would be like. Wouldn't be some little fucking old dude screaming. Like, stop it. You're embarrassing yourself.
Yeah. Reptilian.
Yeah.
Evil's got to be reptilian.
With your obviously planned out rant. You stop it, devil. You don't scare me. You're not the devil. That's the devil lying to you, trying to trick you into thinking that he's not that scary. That was Terrence McKenna's idea of what aliens really were, is that aliens would hide themselves in the idea of an extraterrestrial being that looked like us and walked like us and flew in a spaceship. They would hide themselves in that form as to not disturb us with their true identity, which would be so alien,
sure.
it would be incomprehensible.
Right.
So that, you know, he thought that that's what they were doing when they were appearing in such weird sort of classic forms.
You're talking about the little elven things?
The little grays with the big black
right,
eyes.
Right, that flash around.
Yeah.
Okay.
As if this is something that they would hide in.
Terrence McKenna got me in a lot of trouble.
How's that?
I was... this is the last time I took acid. I got some acid from a guy who sort of knew the Grateful Dead, and so the acid was coming from this...
pure source.
Pretty sweet source,
right
yeah.
from the stream.
So I said, yeah, I'll take some, fine. And this guy gave me all this liquid, right? And I gave some to some friends and whatever, because what am I going to do with 100 hits of acid? You know, I was like 35 or something. And so one friend of mine is a psychiatrist, and he's like 50 or something. This is in Spain. And he had done acid back when psychiatrists would order it, and, you know, from Sandoz, and they just send it mail order. And so he tried three hits and came back the next day and said, yeah, that's good. It's clean. It's mellow. It's cool. So I was reading Terrence McCann and all this shit about heroic doses, right? And I'd, like, done a bunch of acid when I was younger, but I never, like, it had been a while since I'd approached anything you could call a heroic dose. And so I thought, this is the last time I'm probably going to trip, right? I'm sort of at the end of this part of my life, I think. So I'm going to go out with a bang. And I took four hits of this stuff.
Oh.
And it turned into a very intense afternoon that ended up with me a few steps from a psychiatric hospital.
Dude.
Yeah.
I think it was Howard Stern who had a story about taking acid and, like, losing his mind for, like, a couple of weeks, that he took too much. You can get to a point on a psychedelic trip where you question reality to the brink of sanity. You know, you get, like, yeah. you don't know if you're ever going to get back from this one.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's not a feeling that I've had much, tripping. Yeah. And that's why I love tripping, because I always felt I really had my feet under me. And, you know, if I was with people and shit went down, which it sometimes did, I was, like, the go-to guy.
You can keep it together.
Right. Like, I could always, like, okay, get down to
basics
here.
It's so funny.
Here.
We'd like to be cocky and think that we can handle it, because we've handled it before.
Right.
But then all you have to do is just keep going with the level.
Right.
Go, take five hits.
Right.
Like, you can handle four
right.
now?
Right.
Okay, can you handle five? And then right. you're a baby once again.
Well, the thing is recognizing where your limits are
yeah.
and approaching them, testing them, but not ever crossing them or disrespecting them. I mean, that's the way you ride a motorcycle. I like to do dangerous things in a smart way mm-hmm. so I don't fucking
right.
die, you know?
Right, right.
But I like doing interesting, exciting, crazy things, you know?
The problem with acid or any of the drugs that are not legal is that we don't necessarily know what we're getting. You know, if you go to a vodka store, so a liquor store rather, and you buy vodka, you're pretty well be assured that you're buying vodka.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty standard. Everyone
right.
knows what the dosage.
Yeah,
have a couple
right.
of shots, you're going to get fucked up. That's cultural sort of information that's passed on and super readily available. Whereas with yeah. drugs, there's a lot of, are you sure? Are you sure? Is
yeah.
this okay?
Dosage.
Have you done this?
Yeah.
Where did this come from? Who got this?
If you're smart, you're
yeah.
doing that. If
yeah.
you're not, you take some pill somebody gives you. I used to do a lot of research. Well, I didn't do research. I wrote about research that was happening in the world of psychedelics, right? And I gave talks at medical schools, and, you know, I'd go around and sort of be the authority figure on this. And so people always came up to me afterward like, hey, you know, what's the deal with ecstasy, really? Is it dangerous? Is it
yeah.
not dangerous? And it's always complicated, because it's exactly what you're saying. If you're MDMA is one thing, but what you're buying in a club is, if you're lucky, partly MDMA. It might not have any MDMA at all, or at least it's a minor ingredient, and there's a bunch of other shit in there that's unregulated and uncontrolled, and nobody knows what it is. In Spain, you can send ecstasy to a lab, or there are guys in the clubs with labs that'll test it for you.
Yeah, I got some tested the other day that smoked. I guess that was the big thing. If it's smoked, that means it's like almost 100% pure MDMA.
Okay.
And it was night and day difference from what I was used to taking. It was just like
yeah.
fall to the ground and melt. It was amazing.
Right, right. It's a very different thing. And like you say, it's dangerous, you know, because
yeah.
the shit that they mix in them. But acid, LSD, isn't really like that too much, because it's very cheap and easy to make LSD, relatively, for a chemist.
But
so
isn't there bad LSD occasionally? Like, wasn't that the whole thing in the 60s? Like, don't eat the brown acid?
I think that was government propaganda and
really?
Mass hysteria.
Really?
Yeah, because LSD, I'm no chemist, but I've been told LSD is like, if you set up a lab to make LSD, you just make LSD. There's nothing that's going to be cheaper or easier to make instead. Whereas MDMA is much more complicated, and there's money in mixing shit into MDMA.
LSD seems to me to be a legitimate threat to your sanity. There's quite a few people that have gone bonkers
yeah.
After big LSD hits. It seems to me that if you don't have a good solid grip on it, it's possible for it to get away from you and you never get it back.
Yeah.
They suspected that happened to the Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski was a part of the Harvard psychedelic studies, like the in the,
oh, really?
The LSD studies.
Yeah.
And when he got out of school, he went and taught for a few years to save up all his money so he could get this cabin and then start his attack on technology. But you know, the thought was that they cooked his brain. There was a documentary detailing it. I think it's called The Net. I think it's a foreign documentary. It's in subtitles.
Yeah.
But look that up if you can.
But do you really think Kaczynski was insane?
Oh, well, obviously he was insane.
You think
so?
He was
killing all those fucking people.
Yeah, but wasn't he operating essentially out of the same thing that you and I were talking about earlier, where we said you got a people problem on that planet?
Yeah.
He was sort of like...
Sort of, but he was murdering innovators.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's not the way to... That's insanity. Yeah. That's 100% insanity.
Yeah.
You know, even if you thought that the world was doing something bad, that there was something wrong with how... Wouldn't you work to try to change it? Why would you work to try to kill the people that are creating technology?
Like well, I mean, that's the thing. If you think technology is the enemy, I'm not an advocate for the Unabomber.
I think that that's a limited way of looking at things because I think, look, technology, the way human beings operate is the technology will always constantly be moving forward. We're always going to try to innovate. We're always going to try to create better and new things. But I think that same sort of mentality could be applied to cleaning things up or using things in a sustainable way. And I don't think that it's outside the realm of possibility for us to figure out a way to process pollution and make it turn into some sort of a clean fuel. I think the idea of making hydrogen and or using hydrogen turns into water, you know, which is, you know, there's ways we can have fuel and energy that in the future that we can't figure out right now, but there's potential in the future for cleaning up the environment, cleaning up the air, and actually using that as fuel. You know, it is possible.
Yeah. I read somewhere, just in the last few days, like Norway or Denmark, one of those countries, is importing garbage from other countries to use as a fuel source. Because they don't have enough of their own garbage.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're so fucking smart in those little small European countries. Like Iceland, they threw all the bankers in jail. They're like,
you
fucking assholes.
And elected a lesbian to president.
Powerful lesbian president of
Iceland. There's the Net trailer, by the way.
Oh, is this it?
Lost radar contact.
No, this is not. That is not this, Brian. No. Stop it.
Sandra Bullock?
No, no, no.
Really?
No, no. It was a documentary. You fuck.
Did you know that?
You guys being silly over
you
there?
You did that on purpose.
Did you do that on purpose? It's not the Net.
He's sabotaging me.
All right. So talking about the evils of technology, right?
Yeah.
That day I took all that acid. I went into this park with this friend. And we were lying under a tree, and my friend was like, no, I got to walk, I got to move. He's like, okay, you move, man, I'm just going to stay under this tree. I'm under this tree, and it's this big, beautiful tree domed over, and it's a, you know, you can see the blue sky behind the leaves twittering and stuff. It's just so nice. And I started getting into the vibe of this tree, and I could actually, like, feel the vibrations of the tree, the energy vibrations of this tree. And I would align my own energetic vibrations with those of the tree, and it was like a fucking brain orgasm. It would just be like, whoosh, and I, like, whoa. And I couldn't take more than a few seconds of it, so then I'd like get out of phase, right? And then just sort of like, this is all like with my conscious energies, just sort of dancing around, getting into and out of phase with this tree's energy. And every time it was like a full brain orgasm. It was amazing.
Wow.
So anyway, after like an hour or two of this, I was exhausted. I walked out. I started to try to walk. I got out. I walked out from under the tree, and I still heard this buzzing. The vibrations of the tree were sort of moving with me. I turned and I looked back, and right above the tree were these high-tension power lines. And the buzz was coming from the electrical cables on these power lines.
Oh, my God.
I thought I was making love with nature. I was being fucked by technology, man. I felt so violated.
What do you think was going on then when you were trying to tune into the energy of the tree and you had all this electricity? Like, what was going on there?
I'm some sort of, you know, energy overload, you know, frying the circuits in my brain.
They say when you're around certain of those towers, you could feel it. Like, you could, like, it just feels fucked up. It feels like there's...
We used to, when I was a kid, we used to take fluorescent light bulbs out. And if you walked under them with the light bulbs at night, they'd light up.
Get the fuck out of here. They light up.
Yeah.
Wow. What if that made the people that lived under them, like, have superpowers? Could you imagine? Everybody would want to live underneath that and take the chances if, like, one dude became the Flash, like, from, like, DC comic book. You know, it's like you grow up, you're a baby under electricity constantly. You see things that other people can't see. But no, actually, it fucks you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not good to live into those things, is it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it's. Have they ever shown that health wise?
If they did, I doubt there would be houses underneath them still.
Well, yeah. I don't think there are houses underneath them.
Go to Burbank, it's fucking crazy.
Oh. Yeah, out in the country, they cut a line through the woods for them. They don't build houses under them.
Yeah, those things are creepy as fuck. Yeah. It seems like a stupid way to do it.
You know, in Europe, cables are... cords. I mean, those are above ground, but most cables in Europe are underground.
Yeah, why aren't these underground? Why didn't they have them underground? Well, actually, they would worry about someone digging in there and hitting them. Ooh. Have you ever seen what happens when they fuck up and hit like a gas line and blow up a whole block? You know, have you ever seen those? One of them happened recently. I believe it was Indiana. It was unbelievable, the destruction. Someone tapped into a gas line and the house was just devastated.
Yeah.
Whatever happened, it was probably the pilot light in the stove or something. You know, some sort of a gas leak.
Right.
There was no house.
Yeah.
There was nothing. And then the houses next to it were all fucked up, too. But it was just complete splinters.
Hmm.
And these are, like, in our neighborhoods. Like, there's bombs everywhere just waiting to go off. Like, high-pressure gas being pumped into almost everyone's house.
You sound like Woody Allen.
And everybody's cool with it. Woody Allen? Why, does Woody Allen talk like that?
Fearful. Bombs everywhere waiting to go off.
Well, that is if you're near a house that did that, you would start thinking like that. It's just
a house that did that, you wouldn't be thinking at all, man.
What if you're fairly close, like within a couple of blocks, like you managed to survive, but then you'd stop and think about it and go, what the fuck, man?
Yeah.
See, pull up some photos, man. The Indiana house explosion.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that's nothing, though. There's still a house. It's on fire and everything, but it's still a house. In Indiana, like, the house was gone. There's, like, no house.
Yeah,
you know?
And these are like a tornado or something.
Well, we're just so willy-nilly with the fact that we've got gigantic sources of power at our grasp all the time. Electricity in every wall in your house. And very few people even understand it. We just turn the light switch on, turn the light switch off.
Yeah.
No thinking.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, some poor fuck has to put up those crazy cables. And I hope that it doesn't give him cancer, too.
Yeah.
So, this book that you wrote is, I would have to say, a very controversial book. Was it you or was it Bert Kreischer that was telling us a story about someone... Was it Bert about bringing up Sex at Dawn and someone got angry?
Oh, no. I bought it a long time ago when Duncan first started talking about it. Just got it, I think. He told me that. He's like, you should check out this book, man. And I was like, okay. And so I bought it, and then I started reading it, and then I left it in my car, and then the girl I was dating at the time was like, what's this book? I want a book to read tonight. I'm like, all right, take that. And I'm like, then right when I'm giving it to her, I'm like, wait, that was probably a really bad idea.
Why?
Because she read it, and she was just like, oh, my God, this is so anti-marriage and blah, 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 and anti-relationship and stuff like that. She didn't like whatever she read.
So she
got mad at me.
She because of us?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
She didn't know. She just got upset. She's like, why are you reading this book? Like, she almost got nervous, you know?
That's hilarious.
You know what? I one of the first people that read the book was, I guess I could say his name. What the fuck? What was his name? He was a child actor. He was in NYPD Blue. Ricky Schroeder. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, we know Ricky.
Do you?
What did he say?
Oh, fuck. I shouldn't tell you the story.
No, please tell
me. Ricky.
He's crazy. He's a nice guy, but go ahead. Tell the story.
The story is that, so I met him.
Right.
At LAX. I didn't know who he was. We start talking. We're on the same flight to Spain, actually London and then Barcelona, right, because he was living in Barcelona for a while. And he asked me what I did. I said I was about to publish this book. I had one in the galleys, the pre-publication copies. And we talked about the book, and then he came back. He was in first class or something. He came back, there were empty seats, and he and I sat and talked like most of the way to London. And he was really excited about it. He was like, this is going to be amazing. This is really interesting. You know, and then we talked about a screenplay. He was like, you know, is there a movie in this? And he told me about a movie he was working on at the time about Arab terrorists or something like that. Anyway, he was really into it. And I told him the screenplay idea, and he was like, yeah, Kevin Kline in the lead. And, you know, we're talking about who would... And he was, like, super enthusiastic. So he said, do you have a, can I read the book? And you have a copy? I said, I've got this like one copy. It's my last copy, but it'll be out in 2 months, you know, whatever. But yeah, you can have this. Great. Cause I'm going skiing in France or Switzerland or somewhere and I'll read it. And so he's going to get in touch with me when he's back in Barcelona a couple of weeks. Never heard from the guy. And so I was talking to Stanley, my professor, about this. And Stanley said, well, you know, I'm going to see Ricky Schroeder in 2 months in Washington at this event for veterans. I'll ask him what's up. So he did. He saw Ricky at this thing. And he said, hey, you met this friend of mine. And, you know, you were really interested in all this stuff. What happened? And Ricky's wife, according to Stanley, said, I threw that book in the trash. Nobody talks to Ricky about sex except me.
Whoa.
Yeah. That's the story I heard.
Well, I would never repeat that story because it's a story that you heard. It's really hard to get a real solid story through more than one person.
No, it's just one person. But if we could cut it out. Oh, really? It's live.
Yeah.
Oh,
so all this is live.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows what the point is
that a lot of girlfriends and wives have been not interested in the book. And also husbands, I gotta say.
Ricky's a very nice guy. He's a friend of the family. He's a good dude.
Tell him I said hi.
I've hung out with him and his wife many times. His wife's a wonderful lady.
Oh, no. You said tell it. She's, I thought we could cut it out.
It's
if
okay.
It wasn't good. I didn't know.
I don't know. Who knows what really happened? Listen, man, people get into situations. It's not bad, you know. It's your book to a lot of people that have sort of a Sandra Bullock movie view of the world. It becomes very disconcerting.
Yeah.
The idea of for folks who don't know, Sex at Dawn. How would you describe the book? What's the best description of?
It's looking at the origin and evolution of human sexuality. So it's sort of looking at how human beings behaved sexually before there were civilizations telling them what to do and what not to do.
Now, when that subject gets breached, for whatever reason, a lot of women will panic. Like, if you start talking about what people used to do, orgiastic cultures,
right.
And for whatever reason, like, the idea that somehow or another things were different at one point in time, and, you know, maybe males would find that more preferable, or maybe, you know, whatever it is that freaks them out when a guy would read a book like that, that's sort of describing just basically a statement of pretty much fact of history. There's a tremendous amount of evidence to back up the idea that there were orgiastic cultures. So what's wrong with saying that? Like, I don't, that becomes like a real weird, did you feel a lot of that? Did you feel that
sure,
from people?
Sure. You know, and there's a good reason for that response. I mean, the fact is that women are in a situation now and have been for millennia where the only way they could survive really was through a man. Either their father or their husband. And the only thing they had to negotiate with was their sexuality, because the men men had all the property, all the money, all the power, all the everything. The only thing women had was their sexuality. So it's not surprising that women feel threatened if the value of that negotiating chip is lessened, as it is if you start talking about orgiastic societies, right? Then you don't trade your sexuality for your food, your status, and all that other stuff. But the key is to understand that they didn't need to. Our ancestors didn't need to, because the women had direct access to their food and their status and whatever they needed in terms of power. These are very egalitarian societies. But we're not in an egalitarian society now. It's getting better, although women are still making 70 cents on a dollar to men for the same work. If you're a single mother, it's tough in this, especially in the United States, because you're not getting much social support. So those women feel threatened if their negotiating position vis-a-vis men is threatened, as it is if you start talking about loosening up sexual morality.
That's funny, their negotiating position. That's really funny. And that essentially is what a lot of men become. They become negotiating positions. It's a very disturbing thing to see your friend sort of co-opted by some chick who sort of made her way into his life and now is inside of him like a parasite working the controls. Becomes really weird to see.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, we should never forget that women are put in that position. They don't necessarily choose. It's not their nature. In other words, the gold, you know, we're talking about gold diggers or mm-hmm. whatever we're talking about, you know, prostitutes, whatever, women who are trading their sexuality for something explicitly. But we put them in that position.
How is that so if some women don't do it?
Well, women do it to the sense, you know, like the...
I think it's all just a matter of circumstance and a matter of where they are and how it turns out, because there's a lot of women who obviously don't do any of those things.
Because they can work
right.
for the first time in Western history. So we have to understand that's a very novel moment in our history.
Okay. So,
and you still go to play, you know, Pakistan or you know most of Africa, most of Latin America, women don't have direct access to what they need.
So in the origins of civilization, like when we moved from having these sort of small tribes of people to larger cities, is that when the transition sort of happened for women and women became reliant upon men and their jobs lessened because now they're living in cities? And
well, before cities even, just settled society. So we're talking about the advent of agriculture, which is about 10,000 years ago at the earliest. And what's important to understand there is that that's when the notion of private property really entered human society, according to our vision of this stuff. So women weren't that affected women in two ways. One way is that it became very important to trace property, so you had to know who your sons were because it was patrilineal, right? So it's going down the male property was passed father to son. So who are your sons? Well, the only way to know they're your sons is controlling this woman's sexuality, right? Mm, that's the right. only way to know. There are no DNA tests, right? And also, this is the time when people started breeding animals. So it became very clear that one sex act could result in offspring. So this is a very important thing. And if you look in the Bible, what's the line? Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, right? That sounds like something that's talking about respecting your neighbor's marriage. But if you read it in context, it continues, nor his house, nor his servants, nor his ox, nor his sheep, etc. So it's thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property. And his wife is just part of the property. So women really became like, they went from having nearly equal status to males in almost every hunter-gatherer society that we know of, to being property.
That's fascinating. What prompted that? I mean, how did they morph from these tribal societies of equality to these, you know, city societies?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously it would be very complicated to talk about all the different things that happened, but it's important to understand that the human life before civilization or agriculture and after agriculture changed radically in almost every way. Our diet, our exercise patterns, our understanding of interpersonal relationships, governmental structure, how we rule, what kind of decision making happens, child care, sexuality.
Yeah, it's really fucked up
everything.
When you think about it, but a society, a city, you know, agriculture, that was really the first technology. It's like you don't think of it as technology, but that really was. When they figured out how to create things and build things and set things up, that made life more convenient for them or made life easier. And then from then, it's really been all about accelerating that process of invention and innovation, which really started off with agriculture. If you really stop and think about what we were like when we were hunters and gatherers, these small tribes of very tightly knit people that had to stay together and lived off the land, to the first city, from that point on, it was a one-way ticket to nuclear explosions. It was just, we were just on our way to innovating and creating more shelter and safety so you can create better and crazier shit. And literally, the first house, the first city, the first fences they set up, that was the first steps. And if you follow it to the pollution of the earth and nuclear explosions and the space shuttle, all the different things that we've done, it literally all comes from that idea. If we never did that, we would be living exactly like these people that are living in tribal situations in the Amazon,
yeah.
and parts of Africa. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and I'll see that at the beginning of that, you said to make life easier.
or whatever. I shouldn't say easier. Make it easier right then.
It is, yeah, it's exactly. Easier. It's easier right then, but that's the key. I mean, people often say, well, then why? You know, why did we choose to do this? If, you know, because we argue pretty strongly in Sex at Dawn, and then the next book is called Civilized to Death, and that tells you where I'm going with that one, right? So I really question whether it's made life easier or better, you know, and so that's the argument I want to make in that book. But, you know, people think of it as if we chose it. As if our ancestors chose, like, hey, let's all just hang out here and plant some corn, you know, whatever. No, what seems to have happened, agriculture's arisen four or five different times spontaneously in different parts of the world. And in all those different parts of the world, in the years before, by looking at pollen residue and fossils and stuff, they can tell that the years before the advent of agriculture generally tended to be unusually rich, lots of rainfall, lots of plant life, lots of life going on, and then they entered a period where it tightened up and there was much less rainfall, and that's when agriculture arose. So you see that pattern all around. So the thinking is, okay, you've got really rich environment, 20, 30, 40 years, right, several generations, population levels get really high. Then suddenly there's a contraction. So suddenly there's not enough food for everybody, right? Because hunter-gatherer societies tended to be pretty much in balance with, like, every other species with the food supply. So suddenly there's way overpopulation. Most of the time they would just die off. But occasionally, you know, in these five instances, someone figured out, like, wait a minute, this is where all these things grow. There's not enough water, but there's a stream over there. We could dig a channel. So generally, the first steps of agriculture are thought to have been the irrigation. And then later, they figured out, wait, we could take the seeds and put the seeds over here. First, it was just bringing the water to where the stuff was.
And it's really freaky when they keep moving the date of that actually happening back further and further and further. They've just found evidence of cheese making from, like, thousands of 7, years.
7,000 years, I think.
They found evidence in the area near Göbekli Tepe where they might have been making beer 10,000 years ago.
Ooh.
It's really fascinating. Like, they keep going further and further back to when people actually figured it out. But
and apparently hemp was the first thing ever cultivated.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do. Stoners figured it out. You know,
not hydroponic. They were in soil.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't figure out the whole closet setup yet. You go over someone's house and you're like, "Why are you fucking? Why is it so? The hum? What is that hum?
What's that light coming out from under the door?
Open that door and you go, whoa. Like that. Yeah, that the feeling that you didn't really get but thought you got from a tree. Like, you can kind of, you can get a weird communication when you're in a room full of weed plants.
I love growing marijuana. In Spain, it's legal, man. And I had plants every summer on our terrace that were like Christmas trees by the end of the summer.
It's so stupid that people think that if you want pot to be legal, then you also probably want to overthrow the government and, you know, you don't support taxes and you think we should be all hippies. No, stupid. You shouldn't be able to tell people what they can and can't do.
Right.
When it's been clearly proven to not be nearly as dangerous as almost everything else on the world.
Right.
It's just so stupid. It's so stupid at this point in time that you can't have a room in your house where you just have all these plants hanging out and you can go in there and chill with them. You know?
Yeah. Well, our cats always would hang out in the plants.
I bet. Oh, they loved it. Fucking weirdos.
If you could just teach them to hunt those little worms, you know, like, make yourself useful. Eat the worms.
The first time I ever went to a grow room, now granted, I was intoxicated. I was under the spell of the sacred plant. But when I walked into that room, it was literally like walking into like a different sort of consciousness. There was like a different sort of a life coming out of these plants, and there's like, you know, 20 or 30 of them in this room, and they were huge. And I remember being in there going, whoa, like, this feels crazy. Like, this feels like these things are, they're aware, or if not aware, there's something coming off of them. It's not as simple as you know, this is a rock, this is a stick. I wasn't that stoned. I was stoned, but not like stoned enough where I thought that you know, I wasn't really here anymore. It was just fairly normal.
Yeah.
You know, it was like I am right now. But just walking into the room was like, whoa, like, this is intense. I wonder what that is. And then people will tell you that, like, you can talk around plants and it actually makes them grow better. But how much of that is horseshit?
You ever been to Finhorn?
No.
You know what I'm talking about?
Finhorn. No.
That's where the whole playing music for your plants and talking to them and all that started in northern Finland.
I heard that
Scotland.
The music part is bullshit, but the talking part, right. There is some evidence that shows that it might actually help.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't investigated it myself, but...
Well, I know that if I went over your house and all your plants were wilted, I might think you're a creepy fuck. You know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If you go over someone's house and their fucking plants are all jacked, like, get us out of here, this place is toxic.
I kill bamboos, Joe, at my house. Like, those bamboo, good luck bamboo plants, that, like, they're almost, you should not be able to kill them type things. And you just put it in a bottle of water and I still kill those things somehow.
Oh, man.
Well, I'm glad you're proud.
I'm not proud.
I'm excited.
They just die.
You're killing life forms.
I blame cat.
Cats are weird animals, aren't they? They you know, they would make sense that they would go and hang out in the weed room, you know.
Sure,
they'd
it's
pick
warm,
up on it too.
Smells good.
Yeah, and plus, it looks like the jungle to those little creepy fucks. All those trees, they're probably thinking they're gonna be able to jack something. It's funny when you have a cat.
You're not a cat guy.
Oh, I love cats. I have two cats, but they're selfish little assholes. But it's weird. My cat is just big, fluffy cat. She's 16 years old. But I put her in the yard, and there was a bird in the yard, and she fucking went after it and tried to kill it. I mean, it's like you can have them in the house, giving them cat food for 16 years.
Yeah.
But you get them anywhere near a bird, and they go fucking crazy. Their little eyes go and they make that noise.
Does your cat have one of those cat water fountains? I just got one. It's the coolest thing. Cats love the water fountains.
Yeah,
get
they
one
like
of those.
The moving water.
Yeah.
It's cool. So they play with it? Is that what
they
it
just sit there and put their mouth in it and just sit there. And then my cat just like wipes its face in it and then wipes its paws in it. Like, it loves playing with it.
Give me a link and I'll
Amazon.
Get one of those. Right. Powerful Amazon. Well, you know about toxoplasma. Do you know about all that?
Oh, yeah. That's a strange little thing that makes mice attracted to the smell of cat piss.
Yeah.
What a great evolutionary quirk that is.
It removes their fear of them, too. It's really strange.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing is the numbers of humans in the planet that are infested with this stuff.
Yeah.
That it affects behavior and that it might be... They said that France at one point in time was higher than 60%. Yeah, they say they've got it down at around 50-something now, but I mean, how the fuck do they know? Who's getting tested for toxoplasma?
Right.
They think there's at least 60 million Americans that have it.
They think it's related to schizophrenia, right?
They say it could be. They don't know. They know that there's a... Sapolsky out of Stanford is the leading guy in it. I've been trying to get him...
Robert Sapolsky.
Yeah.
He's a primatologist. He's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, he's a fascinating dude.
Yeah,
he apparently is the leading light in this... this thing. Maybe is it the same guy?
Well,
crazy beard?
Yeah, yeah, like Hasidic Jew look, or not Hasidic, but...
just nutty, wacky beard, he's got a lot of videos online talking about it, about how he used to work in an emergency room, and they found that a disproportionate number of motorcycle victims had tested for this toxoplasma.
Really?
Yeah, that it makes you reckless. Makes you reckless, makes you take more chances.
Right.
Yeah, they don't know exactly what the fuck it's doing to you. You know, they don't know exactly, like, how much of an effect it has on some people and other people, whether it takes over their life.
Right.
You know, but for mice, it's a fucking death sentence.
Yeah.
Their dicks get hard for cat piss. It's the craziest thing ever. It's the craziest thing ever. And then they go find them, these rats and mice. And have you ever seen the videos of them?
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah,
they
I've
run
seen
up to the cats.
Yeah.
They're, like, running up to the cat's dick. It's crazy.
What's the doctor's name that found that out?
Sapolsky.
Yeah, he's Robert Sapolsky tells one of my favorite stories ever, talking about humanity and all that. He's for 20-some years, he's been going to Kenya and studying baboons there. Always the same. He's been at the same place for 20 years.
Wow.
And so he's seen generations come and go. He has a great book called A Primate's Memoir, a beautiful book about his years in Kenya.
That's him.
And he's a great writer. Yeah, that's in there. And
little pimp.
So
that guy doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, he's great. How about grooming yourself?
Yeah, he doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah. I mean, he shoots these baboons with blowguns.
Oh, my God.
And then he, like, gets the baboon.
Tranks them?
Tranquils them and does blood tests on their... he's particularly interested in the neurobiology of stress. So he's looking at like how different males in different points of the hierarchy experience stress and stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so the story is that he's watched all these generations come and go, and the baboon troop is very male dominated, and the males are very fierce, and they sort of, you know, they're nasty to the females and to each other and everything. So in the years he'd been going there, the Maasai built a hotel for tourists. And this hotel has a dump. And his baboon troop started going to this dump because there's good food there. And the best food, of course, is meat, scraps of meat that are thrown out by the hotel. So the dominant males tend to get that meat. Nobody else gets any. So one time they threw out some meat that was tainted with tuberculosis. And the upper echelon of this baboon male dominance hierarchy got wiped out.
Whoa.
It was like a bomb went off in Washington or something.
Wow.
And so he was like, whoa, now what's going to happen? This is going to be horrible because when the males reach adulthood, they shift out into a different group. They go out, they leave their natal group, and they go looking for another group. So these new males are going to come in full of testosterone, looking to kick ass, and there won't be anyone here to fight them off. It's going to be like pirates landing on an island with no men on it, you know? But what happened was the new males came in. In the meantime, the group developed a much more egalitarian, low-stress way of life. And when the new males came in, they adopted this new way of life.
Whoa.
So 5 years later, last I heard from him, 5 years later, this group, this troop of baboons, was still significantly less uptight than any other troop that has ever been studied.
Isn't that hilarious? That sort of mirrors America, that if you could, like, poison the military-industrial complex with, like, sacred caviar from some
See, now we're back to the Unabomber,
yeah,
all right?
Yeah.
I'm not defending him. I'm just saying there is an
internal logic.
Well,
not really,
logic.
Because he was going after fucking scientists, yeah, and professors. He was a nut.
if it had been senators, he would have been fine.
It's like that quote that no one ever wants to get heard saying, well, Hitler had a couple of good ideas.
Exactly.
It's most people that are, you know, young folks, people that have regular jobs, people that are, you know, out there sort of tuned in and connected to the world, are very frustrated by the way this country and the world in general is run, because it's run by this one small group of people all throughout the world,
right,
that have a vested interest in keeping it running that way.
Right.
And in that situation, I mean, no one's advocating that anybody do this, but in that situation, it really does mirror this baboon society where these dominator baboons got jacked and then everybody just chilled the fuck out.
Right.
And then new people came in and they also chilled the fuck out.
Right. The problem with that, I mean, I tend to agree with you, but I think...
The problem with that is the Patriot Act. You can't even say that shit.
What's that?
I said the problem with that is the Patriot Act. Even just saying that,
right,
is like, can get you in trouble.
Yeah, so I tell a bad story and you get thrown in prison. This is going really
story.
Well so far.
It's a very good story.
No, but what I was going to say is that I'm a little less hopeful than you are, in the sense that I think even if the upper echelon of the male baboons got wiped out, we'd probably end up right back where we are, because there's too many people.
Yeah, there's too many people. That's for sure. But there's not too many people if everybody stops jacking each other and stealing resources. There's not too many people if we don't engage in our culture is essentially a war culture. I mean, that's just what it is. I mean, we're constantly involved in these overseas conflicts, controlling parts of the world that we don't really have any business in. We have military presence in something like 100 different countries. I mean, we're crazy.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of taxes. It's a lot of shit. And if we weren't spending it on that and we were instead spending it on some sort of sustainability, I mean, if you could get the direct proportion amount of money that's spent waging war and spend that same amount of money trying to enhance the life of people that are in shit situations, we would have an exponentially more beautiful world to live in, and the same amount of money would still be circling around. It's not like industry couldn't exist if it wasn't for war. That's nonsense. Yeah. That's just something we've been told by the people that are controlling where we go and what we do.
But isn't war uniquely profitable in that you're destroying very expensive stuff, whether it's the infrastructure of a country or your own munitions? You know, $1 million a pop for a Predator drone strike or something like that, that always needs to be replenished, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you're building, you know, TVs or chairs or jerk-off cans or whatever it is that, there's a certain number that you build, and then like that's all anyone needs for a while.
Yeah.
So I think there's a built-in impetus to blow shit up, because then you get paid to rebuild it.
That's the Halliburton ideology.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, it certainly seems like that's something that goes on.
Yeah.
I mean, that certainly seems to be fueling a lot of the activity that we do. But I don't think that that's necessary. If you fly over the country just one time, you realize how much open space there really is. You know, yeah. And that's not just here that's like that.
Yeah.
The idea of overpopulation is mostly based around the fact that 80% of our people live near water. You know, if we figured out a way to make our lives more sustainable, to make cities more sustainable, to pollute less, and had all the people that are involved in all this nonsense overseas and dedicate them to doing that, yeah. We wouldn't be as reliant on foreign oil. We wouldn't be as reliant on all these things that we need in these other places.
Sure.
It's just we're governed in a shitty way, and we're governed in this representative way where nobody feels connected to the actual decisions that are being made.
Yeah.
Vaguely connected.
Who's being represented? Yeah. Let's be serious. It's corporations are being represented.
Yeah.
The rest of us, was it Zappa who said politics is the entertainment division of the military-industrial complex?
That's brilliant.
Isn't that nice?
Oh, Zappa was brilliant. Yeah. What a great quote. Yeah, until humans actually get a say in everything that happens, until the United States gets to vote on our activities.
But this is the thing, you know, there's so many fucking people that to manage this many people, I think the systems that work are dehumanizing, inherently dehumanizing. I think that there's a question of scale that it seems to be. You know, it just sort of makes sense. If you're talking to 10 people, you know, each of those people gets a tenth of your attention. If you're talking to 100 million people, you know, nobody's getting your attention.
Right, right.
And so I think there's sort of a mathematical, almost like a quality of life, a limited quality of life. And the more people there are, the more people are taking a little piece of it, and the smaller the pieces get, you know?
That's fascinating. But then if that's the case, then how come some people are just fucking living high on the hog?
Well, that's the thing. You know, we're talking about this upper echelon, right? The mm-hmm. people who meet in Davos or whatever, right?
What's Davos?
You know, in Switzerland where all those guys meet in the, you know.
The Bilderberger type characters.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I've known some of those people, not a lot. I've known some people very, very up in the world, and they're no happier than anybody else, man. You know, and I think a lot of them are actually less happy.
Yeah.
Because happiness isn't about being able to buy whatever you want. You know, I mean, that wears out.
It is, unless you're in a great neighborhood and you have good friends and you know a good escort agency. If you have all that
are we going into a commercial here?
No, we don't. We're not represented by any escort agencies yet.
Yes.
Holla.
Exactly.
The idea that the richest people are the happiest people is ridiculous. Another Herzog video that I really enjoyed was Life in the Taiga, Happy People. It's called Happy People, Life in the Taiga.
No, I haven't seen
it. About Siberia, these people that live up in Siberia.
And the eagle hunters?
No, that's in Tibet, actually.
Ah, okay.
Siberia is the Life in the Taiga people are these trappers that live in this very small town where they essentially don't use money. They trap and they take the money from trapping, and that's what buys like tools and equipment and shit. And they, you know, they use it to trade for different things. But all they do is hunt and fish. They hunt, they fish, they grow food. Right. And they're so happy.
Yeah.
And the men, they disappear in the winter to go trapping. They take snowmobiles. They drive like a fucking 100 miles in a snowmobile. And when they come back, everybody's happy. They have these celebrations. The dogs run behind them when they come back. And if the dogs don't make it, tough shit. And these people have like no mental illness. They're all happy. They're all like cheering and dancing and singing. And it really makes you wonder. Like when you look at us, you know, people are sitting on their couch. Oh, I'm so bummed out.
Right.
Oh, I'm so depressed.
Right.
Like for what? What are you bummed out about? Like you don't have to do anything right now.
Yeah.
Like you are in a position right now where you can actually relax.
But see, that's it. That's it. He's bummed because he doesn't have to do anything right now.
Is that the problem?
Yeah, there's no meaning. There's no meaning. It's like there's meaning in food when you grow it. Like we're talking about marijuana. There's meaning when you're smoking bud that you grew and you cut and you trimmed and you cured. It's like you love it. If you make your own beer, your own wine, you cook your own dinner, whatever it is, right?
I went hunting recently. I killed a deer, and I've been eating this deer for the past 4 months. And when I eat it, I feel like a sense of satisfaction. It's like this like was a lot of effort. I had to go like hiking in Montana and camping outside in 12 degrees, and I got this thing. It's like such a much better connection than going to the store and just picking out a steak.
Yeah.
We still have all these reward systems set up from hunter-gatherer cultures,
don't we? That's it. And the problem, the ultimately destructive conundrum at the heart of civilization is that it leads us to where we think we want to go, but it isn't really where we should be. It isn't really the place that's going to make us happy, right?
Right.
Like everyone thinks if you win the lottery, you're going to be happy. Look at studies of people who've actually won the lottery. Their lives get destroyed in short order.
That's because they don't know me. I could hook them up. They're hanging around with the wrong people. They're staying in the same neighborhood. They didn't change their name.
Yeah.
The first thing you do, you take all that money and go to Canada. You go right to Canada. You go to Toronto where nobody knows you, and you party, bitch. You start partying. You got how much money? Oh, man, you just need an organizer. You just need someone to monitor. You won $300 million. We're going to make you happy, dude.
Yeah.
And then you get him enrolled in yoga classes, keep his brain sharp.
Yeah.
You know, give him crossword puzzles to do. He's going to be okay, man.
We'll take care of you. For $100 million, we'll take care of you.
The problem with those dudes is they stay in Georgia, they eat Chick-fil-A's, and they just fuck themselves, and they fall apart.
Yeah.
You can become happier when you win the lottery. You just got to get hooked up with the right people.
It's possible, but in general, that's not what happens.
No, you can't appreciate all, joking aside, you can't appreciate things unless you earn them. You know, you really, you know, I joked about it once when I was younger that the amount of work involved to become a stand-up comedian, it's so difficult to go from in the beginning where you just suck to being a competent stand-up comedian that the idea of doing it all again is absolutely terrifying. It's terrifying. And I would have never done it if I hit the lottery. Like if I hit the lottery when I was 21 and I had millions of dollars, where would my ambition go? And then with that gone, also there's like the character lessons and failing and in, you know, awkward moments and in social situations, all the different various little bits of information that you use to sort of formulate your own personality and view of the world. Those wouldn't exist.
Right.
They would exist in a completely different form because you wouldn't be struggling to make your way through the world with insecurity like most of us have. You would all of a sudden have fucking $300 million and be in your underwear in a yacht like you're in a Jay-Z video. You would just keep going until the wheels fell off.
But the other thing is you wouldn't really have any friends. Because if you're just a regular person and people hang out with you, you can be pretty sure they're hanging out with you because they like hanging out with you.
Right.
If you just won the lottery and people are hanging out with you on your yacht in your Jay-Z video, you don't know why those people are there.
That's true, but I've heard that argument before about like being a celebrity. Like, oh, people just like you just because you're – how do you know when people actually like you? You can kind of tell when people like you.
Yeah, but that's because you've been through it.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm saying if you come up in that world.
Yeah. You know? You can definitely – you'll definitely see people that are bullshitting you for sure. I mean if you just won $300 million, you're going to have some good friends.
You're going to
have a lot of good bullshit. Oh, my God. How are you? Oh, my God. I'm so happy for you. Oh, my God. We have to celebrate. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, someone's trying to fucking look at you like you're a puzzle. Like, I got to figure out a way in this motherfucker and extract some money off of this bitch. You know, the people will look at you like that. If you were some dude who just, especially if you just got lucky. It's one thing if you're some crazy fuck who starts a landscaping business and owns 100 different, you know, fucking warehouses filled with lawnmowers and you're sending people out every day. You know, I mean, you like bust your ass and you created an empire. That's one thing. Like, you respect that guy.
You stumble into it.
Yeah. People won't immediately, if they know that you're, you know, Lenny the Lawnscaper King, they don't go after you. But if you're Lenny the fucking douchebag who was working
at the lottery king.
He was working at CVS and all of a sudden scratched the right ticket. And boom. They will go after you. You don't deserve it. They're like, fuck that guy.
You just got to get your money's worth from every one of the girls. You know, just really use them all day long.
Yeah, but it's not girls that are going to go after you. It's business people. it's a lot of people like, come on, I got this business, I'm going to get started. You know how many times people come up to me and want to start a business? And it's such a ridiculous idea. Yeah. But I'm always like, hey, I'm not going into business with you. Yeah. We're not starting a business together. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? That's not how you make. Go to a bank, bitch. There's money in there. They have money. You go and you sign out some papers. And you get a loan. You crazy asshole.
I remember reading this thing years ago, like 10 years ago. This guy, he didn't win a lottery, but he inherited like $20 million. His parents had a farming business or something.
That is the lottery, right?
So he inherits $20 million. He's like 24 years old or something. And he gets a few friends together, and they fly to Monaco. And he's like, yeah, he's going to celebrate with a wild weekend in Monaco with five or six of his friends. 4 days later, all $20 million was gone.
Whoa.
Lost it all.
Oh, my God.
4 days.
Gambling?
In Monaco. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So they said to him, how did it happen? And he said, well, gradually at first and suddenly at the end.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
That sums it up, doesn't it, man?
Wow. That is insanity. Well, you can go insane gambling. That's one of the arguments for gambling being illegal. I don't support that argument. I don't agree with it whatsoever. I'm a 100% proponent of personal freedom and personal responsibility. But I've seen people get that crazy gambling eye, and it's a sickness. Mm. And it's to exploit that sickness. It's like, I mean, it's akin to having sex with a girl who's passed out from being drunk. That's what exploiting that. It really is.
Oh, exploiting the gambler. Exploiting the gambler's the drunk girl.
Sick.
Okay, right.
Who's that sick and over the end, and just like letting him continue to gamble. Like, someone needs to come. No, because I believe in personal responsibility. No. But realistically, if you were like, you had any ethics whatsoever, and you saw some guy who's about to bet $20 million, you know, you would go, hey, dude, this is not a good time.
Yeah.
Okay,
move to my neighborhood.
Relax.
Meet my friends.
Calm down, okay? Yeah. I mean, one thing to play a little blackjack, $1,000 hand here or there. Yeah. Let's get crazy.
Yeah.
But give yourself a fucking limit.
Yeah.
You're about to lose $20 million in a day.
Yeah.
Stop it.
So it sounds to me like you've got the same sort of career ambitions I have.
What is that?
Which is to hang out with really wealthy people and help them not fuck up. I mean, I had this dream of like I was going to be like the psychiatrist to, you know, like I'll be a psychologist to like, you know, movies. George Clooney would be much better off if I would hang out at his house.
You know, you say that and it's kind of a funny thing, but in other cultures, throughout history, there have been wise men that hung around great men that offered them advice.
Yeah, definitely.
Because especially men who are like big businessmen and, you know, and back in the day, you know, conquerors even would have a sit down with scholars and they would discuss certain issues.
Yeah.
It was like important to sort of be surrounded by people like that. But in this sort of society, it's sort of gone the way of the shaman. No, there's no shamans, there's no scholars in your midst, there's no, you know, just intellectual that you keep handy.
Mm.
You know, now we have Google, we don't need that guy anymore.
All right, yeah.
But but wisdom, you know, and especially wisdom in response to personal issues.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. We have it, I guess personal coaching is sort of as pathetic as that sounds.
Yeah.
No, seriously. Yeah. I'm talking about the modern rendition, you know, like people who are your personal coach.
Oh, like life coaches?
Life coach.
Here's
that's what
my
it's
example
called.
With, with a life coach. Yeah. There was a guy who was I am fascinated by women who always – successful women who always date losers.
Mm.
And I've seen quite a few examples of it. It's really fascinating to me. You know, to watch this weird dynamic when there's a really successful woman and a guy who's essentially a fuck-up, just a total fuck-up. Well, this guy was he was a nanny to this really successful woman, a male nanny. And my friend, who, like, knows the family, was like, what the fuck is that? That's not going to end well. Of course it doesn't end well. She winds up dumping her boyfriend and hooking up with the male nanny. So then the male nanny is living in the house, like the big house where he was like taking care of the kids. He's the boyfriend now, and now he's a life coach.
Oh boy.
Like out of nowhere, the nanny's a fucking life coach, and I'm like, whoa, like there's some fuckery afoot in that household.
Yeah.
This someone is just like that's like a guy who's like essentially like a two or three steps removed from being a con artist, and he's managed to fit himself into this semi-legit situation where he's got this poor, confused rich lady.
So is he coaching his clients to get jobs as nannies for poor for rich ladies?
I've resisted getting close to them in like conversations at parties and stuff like that because I don't trust myself.
Yeah.
I don't trust my
– like sexually?
No.
With
my
coach?
My chimpanzee rage.
You might say something or
I might he's gross. I've had a conversation with a guy once before and it was just like, whoa. Like he's just gross.
Speaking of chimpanzee rage, or do you want to continue with the gross thing?
No, I was just going to say, there's like certain people you talk to and they're like, have you ever like been around someone who literally was like a Hollywood character, like in a movie where like literally just like completely fake, like if pulling your pants down to the crack your ass was in, they're going to do
it. Oh yeah, sure.
If this is,
sure.
You know, like, that was this guy. Yeah. He was just like this, it was like this. Almost like a an alien that was taking on the form of a human, you know.
Yeah,
he
exactly.
was so Hollywood. I mean, he had like everything you could ask for. He had beads, like wooden beaded necklace, and you know, his hair was in a ponytail. I wanted to throw him through the universe. It was just everything about him. And then the fact that I found out that this guy had hooked up with the lady, and you're friends
with the lady.
No, I don't know the lady at all. Oh, okay. No. The lady's just this old broad that we know.
Right.
she's how old? Like Angela Lansbury?
She's older than him. Look, there's a lot to this story that I'm going to have to get personal if I keep going any further.
Yeah, and I don't want to.
Yeah,
Jesus,
that's
all right.
Ricky's a good
guy. I feel terrible.
Listen,
about that,
Ricky was on the podcast.
I never tell that story. I've never included his name until right now when I told that story.
He would tell that story. Trust me.
All right. I just don't want to.
Yeah, he would laugh about how his wife would never let him read that.
Yeah, I mean, I had a great time talking. That's why it was memorable. It's like, wow, this guy's cool, and he was going to come play poker with us and I do this basketball thing and he was going to come. I don't care if we don't do the project together, but why didn't he call me?
And his wife's a wonderful lady. She's just got her thing, you know. Everybody's got that. Together it works. I'm not judging.
You're talking about reactions to the book, right?
Like, Brian?
Brian's girlfriend who didn't like the book, right? Or didn't like the idea of the book. We've had so many really personal responses to the. It's so people either, you know, they respond to it positively or negatively, but it's very personal.
Sexuality is very personal, you know.
Yeah,
and the idea that you're fucked up because you're attracted to other people.
Right.
That's very personal too, because it's sort of a secret that a lot of people harbor around inside of them.
Sure. And some people, women have written to us, lots of women, to say that they had to stop every 10 pages and masturbate.
Oh, what a good girl.
Yeah.
What a good girl.
Yeah, I did not see that one coming, so to speak.
Wow.
I never fantasized.
By the way,
they also
masturbate while watching Max and Ruby, while they're eating Cheerios.
That's right.
Those are freak bitches.
Every 10 minutes, no matter what they're doing.
This is one in a million that are just like that, period, no matter what. It's such an interesting subject because of the fact that our society is set up to sort of create this image that gives us these positive sort of feelings inside of our brain when we watch them in a movie or on a television show or even hear about them in a song, but they don't necessarily represent reality. But our brain is not set up for the media. Our brain is not set up for the influence of television or a movie.
Yeah.
Our brain is set up to imitate successful behavior.
Right.
And we're set up to sort of learn from our environment. But we have this new thing now, and it's 60 feet high, and the fucking words are perfect because a team of writers worked on what Brad Pitt was going to say for like 2 weeks before he actually said it. I mean, it was like really meticulously done down to the exact comma. And then it's music is playing while he's saying the perfect thing. And your version of reality all of a sudden has a new model.
Mm.
And your version is based on bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Sandra Bullock's life was not a Sandra Bullock movie.
Right.
Think about how every Sandra Bullock movie is like this sweet thing and, you know, monogamy rules and it all works out in the end. Meanwhile, she was married to Jesse fucking James, a guy with tattoos all over his body, who was banging everything like a savage.
Just like your friend with the old lady.
Your
friend. Sorry. So you think that he
was using Sandra Bullock?
You don't think so?
No, I bet he really loved her. I bet he's a damaged dude. And I bet he really loves pussy. I bet that too. Yeah, I don't think he was using her. I don't know, though. I mean, I don't assume.
I always thought that's why people hated him, because he was like some unknown guy who was screwing this super everybody's baby, you know, everybody.
She probably liked him. She probably liked it. I mean, she couldn't. When you like a guy, even if he's like a deceptive guy like that guy, there's obviously something about him that she must have liked. And sure. She must have enjoyed his company. It couldn't have all been fake.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say it was, but. What is it? Okay, when someone's inspired around a person, they act differently or act better. Is that fake too? I mean, are you fake because you're better? Are you fake because you like someone so much that you aspire to be kinder around them or nicer around them? Is that? I don't know if that's fake or not. I don't know the dude, but yeah. I know that her life, her movies were all these really beautiful, sweet movies that give you a warm feeling that it's all going to work out.
Right.
And then her whole life was that life was she was. He was fucking that crazy girl with her fucking tat. What was tattooed on her forehead? We talked about it yesterday. We thought she had, you thought she had Nazi tattoos, but they were just photos.
No, she did.
No, she has WP on her legs.
No, right here on her throat, she has a little Nazi symbol. And
no.
There was like a lot of people that found photos of it.
Oh, really? That might not be real. You got to be careful about that shit. You can't,
I'll show you.
It's funny that the swastika used to be like a symbol of good luck.
Still is in Tibet and Nepal.
They still use it?
Yeah.
That's bold.
Yeah. I saw this guy in Bangkok. First time I was in Bangkok in the late 80s. This guy, Thai guy, wanted to open a bar that would attract tourists because you can make more money from tourists, obviously. So he was looking in old Life magazines to try to get a motif that foreigners would relate to. And he came across photos of the Nazis. He didn't know what was going on. He didn't know about World War II. He was, like, completely out of touch with this. But he liked the imagery. So he did up his bar in all this Nazi imagery.
Oh,
not,
no.
Not thinking it was going to attract the foreigners, right? Because he was in this foreign magazine. Opening night did not go as planned.
It's crazy because you can go back far enough and you can rock that. Like, you could get Genghis Khan shit and put it all over your house.
Exactly.
And
there's
nobody
a statute
would have a problem
of limitations.
Yeah. I mean, you could go back to, like, Alexander the Great, if you could find, like, some Alexander the Great memorabilia. But if you have any Nazi memorabilia in your house.
Yeah, that's a no-no.
That's a no-no. You can't have anything. You can't have a hat, a gun. You can't have anything with an SS. You can't have anything. Yeah. Like, it's too quick. It's too, even though it was 1947 or whatever it was when it ended, still too close.
Yeah, you mentioned Chimp Rage earlier.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of something I was thinking when I was watching your special, which, by the way, I'm sure you don't need me to plug it, but anyone who hasn't downloaded that thing should not consider themselves a true fan.
That's ridiculous.
Fantastic.
Thank you, man. I'm glad you liked
it. It was really, really good.
Thank you.
And then, of course, I put it up on BitTorrent.
Good.
Yeah.
Throw it out there.
Here's Radar Magazine. It shows Jesse James' mistress with the swastika.
Oh.
Is that really a swastika in the center of that bird?
Yeah.
Where is it? On her neck?
Oh, right. That's close up.
Oh, wow. That's dark. Oof.
That's a really painful place, right, to get a tattoo, right?
Well, she's got one on her forehead, man.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's...
Other than that, she's kind of hot in a dirty way, right? Yeah. But my point being that we have these, where I started before this, we have these reward systems set up from being hunters and gatherers, and they're sort of hijacked by movies and TVs and film.
Yeah.
And when something comes along like your book, where it pretty much just factually breaks down the history of sexuality. And what I thought was really interesting is one of the things about the word promiscuous and the origins of the word promiscuous, that it meant mixed.
Right.
And that we look at it as some sort of loose morals and some we have attached this sort of judgment to it.
Yeah.
And when in fact the idea of promiscuity of today, fucking strangers, really didn't even exist in these cultures.
Right.
Everybody knew each other.
Yeah, that gets us back to what we were saying earlier about numbers. It does come down to raw numbers at a certain point. You remember Robin Dunbar's number?
Yes.
Did you get to that?
150.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I'd heard about that before, actually. Yeah. We talked about it on the podcast. Because I have a real issue with remembering people's names.
Right.
I can recall crazy shit from fights that happened 15 years ago while we're brought. I have a really good retention of information. But at a certain point in time, like I ran out of room for people's names. And I felt it. I actually felt it happen.
Right.
You know, where it's like, and people will, you'll meet someone, you don't remember what their fucking name is, and then they tell you, and then all their file pops up again. Mm-hmm. Like it was on temporary delete, and you'll, all of a sudden you have access. Oh, yeah, you're Billy's brother. Yeah. Oh, okay. And then all his file, like, fills back in. It's and do very
you,
strange.
Do you, like, forget people's names as you're hearing them, like at a party or something?
I do, unless I'm paying attention. I try not to do that because it's rude. You know, yeah. There's that weird thing that happens when you know, you're at a party and you're meeting, like, 10 people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like it gets really overloaded.
It's really hard to like put them all into a file.
Yeah,
you know, I almost want to write it down. Okay, Bob, that's what you're saying. Okay, yeah. Take a picture of you, yeah. Bob.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
There's an app for that.
But then
I'm
he'd
sure.
be then he'd be like looking at his phone when he came back to talk to you. Oh yeah, 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 Bob. Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Let's pick up where we left off. Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Can I take notes on our conversation? Just see, but you're the NASA guy. Okay.
Yeah. No, I was saying earlier when I was watching your show, I was thinking about something, and maybe you can respond to this. Like you watching you like the way you prowl on stage, I had this. I thought, man, that's a comedian who could kick my ass, and I can't think of any other comedian who I've. You know, are there tough comedians?
I don't know.
Generally, comedians are sort of, you know.
I thought, and when I first started working for the UFC, I thought it would. I never brought it up on stage, and I thought maybe this is like really good if people don't know about this. Like on stage, I never on stage have I ever talked about martial arts or anything that I've ever done, like physically,
right.
Until the UFC became so big, like in the mid 2000s, after like 2005, it was sort of inevitable at
right.
that point.
Right.
But before then, like I would never talk about martial arts on stage.
Would it
never
fuck
talk
up the humor? Do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Right. Because I look like a meathead. Anyway, you know, if I didn't know me and I would guess like what would come out of my mouth, I'd be like, this fucking idiot, what's he going to talk about? Protein?
Right.
You know, we could talk
right.
about, well, how much creatine you take, stupid. You know, I would make fun of myself. So
yeah.
It's automatic that I think yeah. that people make fun of me or that they would discount me as a right. comedian, you know, but that's just the way I look like, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. My interests have always been in martial arts. I can't help it. I mean, I'm still completely fascinated and dedicated to the art of stand-up comedy. I love doing it. It's my favorite thing to do in life. But I like martial arts too. Like, why?
Yeah.
It's a weird thing that we're supposed to like hide that in some way. But as a comedian,
no, I think you've transcended it. Which,
I got lucky.
Which is what I noticed. And it's like, wow, there's something inherently contradictory about
yeah.
a tough, you know, type A alpha male comedian. It's not funny. Because that's a guy, you know, that it's there are two roles in conflict. And
well,
you pull it off.
Well, somehow or another, also, like people, the beautiful thing about having a podcast like this is the podcast's popularity came right after the UFC's popularity. And with a podcast, essentially, there's nowhere to hide.
Right.
You know, this is who you are.
Right.
And when you're talking for 4 hours, or what did we do yesterday? 4.5 hours with Bert Kreischer. Everybody knows who you are. That's you. You're that guy.
Yeah.
You're that guy. It's good or bad, you know?
At that point, they're hanging out with you.
Yes.
It's not edited.
Right.
Much
so it's
to
like if
chagrin.
You have a friend. Like, I have a friend, my friend John Rollo. And John Rollo is a great guy. But he's one of the scariest looking human beings you've ever seen in your fucking life. He's built, he's about 300 pounds of solid muscle. He's a ridiculously big guy. And on his chest, he has a tattoo of an angel choking a devil unconscious, okay? I mean, he's just a frightening man. His arms are – I'm not bullshitting. There's maybe three – you've seen John Rollo. About three of my arms. His arms are probably like three of my arms. And he's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt.
Wow.
He's just this big, giant dude. But – everybody who knows him, when you're around him, he's a sweetie. He's
right.
got like a bunch of cats.
Right.
And he's
yeah.
the gentlest guy you'd ever want to be around. So when you're around him and he's saying funny shit, you laugh.
Yeah.
Why? Because you know John.
Right.
But if you met John at a restaurant and he started laughing, you're like, is he laughing before he just fucking snaps and kills everybody
exactly.
in this place? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like once
sure.
you get to know
sure.
him, then it doesn't matter that he's this big, giant, scary dude.
Right.
He's just
right.
John, you know, yeah. just hanging with John.
Yeah.
So I think that has allowed me to sneak in because I did other things because of Fear Factor and
right.
the UFC stuff. People got to know me already, so they
right.
like accepted a certain amount
right.
of the weird, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a comedian, you sort of always thought like you don't want to go Joe Piscopo style.
Right.
You know, Joe Piscopo was like on the cover of Muscle and Fitness, fucking flexing, and that was like the end.
Really?
Like everybody's like, you can't be like a bodybuilder and be funny. Like,
yeah.
get out of here, stupid.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because one of the reasons I noticed it, as I said to you, I've been living in Spain for 20 years, right? So I didn't know anything about Fear Factor or UFC or none of that stuff is like on my radar, right? I'm in Barcelona. I don't have cable or whatever. So yeah, it was like seeing it all for the first time. It was interesting. Yeah.
What were you doing in Spain for 20 years?
growing weed.
That's it. Just growing weed in Spain.
I'm joking. Lots of different things. You know, I was teaching some English. I was translating, editing. I worked as an in-house translator and editor for the biggest porn company in the world for a while. They're based in Barcelona. Yeah. I had a gig as interpreting from Ebonics to English, if you can believe that, for a film festival. Yeah.
Interpret? I've like, had some like weird jobs. Airplane? Like the lady on Airplane? Exactly. I speak jive?
Exactly. It's exactly. Really,
that's a gig?
That's on my resume, man. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy. That's a fascinating gig.
Yeah. Well, the way it happened.
What did you have to interpret? Like people?
Well, yeah. What happened was there's this film festival called In Edit, and it's independent films, right? So this one year they were doing focusing on films about the origins of rock and roll, jazz, blues in the Delta, right? So like old time Delta guitarists, Delta blues guitarists, and also the origins of hip hop in Brooklyn in the 70s. And so they had a team of like 20 Spanish translators who were great and understood English very well, but they couldn't understand these black people, right? So first they call up this black dude who was friends with one of the translators, and he listened to the stuff, and he couldn't understand either because he's British. So one day I get this call from my friend Pinky, and she's like, Chris, do you understand black people? And I had a black girlfriend for a while. I thought she meant on some conceptual level, you know, like some. And I was like, yeah, I guess, you know, I'm a shitty dancer, but I understand.
Now, did you drink like Colt 45 to accentuate the process?
To get into the role?
Smoke a joint, go, what's up? What's
right. up? I'm a method translator. Wow. No, so she gave me the DVDs, and all I had to do was just watch the DVD, and they were like, okay, in this part, what's he saying there? And he's like, yo, I'm up my crib. Like, yeah, we're going back to my apartment. And okay, good. And then they do the Spanish part, so I didn't even have to go into Spanish.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
That's really funny. Wow.
Yeah, I've had lots of
weird jobs. Did you ever think of just like throwing in some fake translation just to fuck with them, just to be silly and get bored with it?
Yeah, no. I did a good job.
That's hilarious. So you were over there for 20 years. Yeah. Did you? I mean, everybody says that.
I mean, I'm still over there officially.
Actually. Oh, are you really? Yeah. You just visiting here?
More or less. I'm basically. It sounds so Hollywood, man. I'm here to pitch a TV show.
That does sound a little Hollywood. Sounds I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah. I'm gonna get some beads and put my hair in a ponytail. And,
you don't have to do that. Yeah, you don't have to do that.
I'm going for it.
What's the TV show about? Can you say?
About sexuality. It's called Sex Drive.
Is it like one of those History Channel shows?
Well, I mean, we'll see what happens. But the idea of the show is I developed the show in Vancouver this summer with a friend, a guy you might know, actually. Or at least, did you see I Am Bruce Lee?
Yes.
He's the director of that.
Oh, okay. What's his name?
Pete McCormick.
Okay.
He also did a great film on Muhammad Ali called Facing Ali.
Oh.
Have you seen that?
That's all the guys who Ali fought.
Yeah.
Talk about him.
Exactly.
No, I heard about it, but again, it really depresses me watching an old boxer slur. It depresses the shit out of me.
Yeah.
I really have a problem with it. With any old athlete that's got issues, it really bothers me. So I didn't watch it.
It's a great film. It's really moving, actually.
Yeah, I bet.
It's very touching because it's, you know, you go into it I went into it thinking, okay, it's about boxing. It's about macho, tough ass guys. It's not, man. It's about love. It's about charity. I mean, Ali used to like set up some of the fights, like the not the main contender fights, but between the title bouts, you know, where you fight someone for the title, but you know the guy is not going to win. It's a tune-up match.
Uh-huh.
Well, he scheduled some of those to help dudes out. Like he heard this one guy. I think his son had overdosed and his wife committed suicide. And he just had this horror. He's going through this horrible period in his life. And Ali would be like, get him. He line him up, talk to his people. And so he'd do it to give these guys an infusion of cash.
Yeah.
And Kenny Norton was like living in his car when he fought Ali.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a really good movie, man. It's really, and Joe Lewis, Joe Frazier is like crying at one point.
Wow.
Talking about Ali.
Wow.
Very interesting. I said to Pete, how did you get, because you don't hear Pete at all. It's just the people being interviewed. But they're so vulnerable, man. It's a beautiful film. And I said, how did you get Joe Frazier to be that open about Ali? Because he hated Ali.
Right.
You know? And Pete said, you know, I said to him, look, Joe, you know, like, yeah, you know, I know how you feel about the fighting and all that. But when you look at Ali now as a man, just as a man, how do you feel? What do you think? You know, and that really brought it out of Joe Frazier.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing film.
It must be weird to go and have conversations with someone about a dude that you fought just 15 years ago and you're still talking about him. And people still want to know about it. Not even 15 years ago. It was really 25 years ago, whatever it was when they fought. That was a long fucking time ago. When did they fight? They fought in the 70s, right?
Yeah, well, he was fighting from the early 60s, I think. Wasn't he in the Olympics in 62, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was 67 to 70 was when they
took him out.
Them.
Yeah.
So you're talking about 40 fucking plus years ago. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And Joe Frazier recently died.
Yeah. He died within a year of doing that interview.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, so I developed the show with Pete. And the idea of the show is to try to get the same tone of Sex at Dawn. So it's got some scholarly heft, but it's also fun to be there, like to read it or to be in the show. So it's without being juvenile, to be playful and open, but without being BBC professorial, to be scholarly.
So it's like Ancient Aliens, but with sex. You ever see that show?
No, I haven't seen that.
Like if aliens squirted.
The aliens squirt.
No.
Yeah.
No. Ancient. You actually turned your microphone on to say that, too. Your mic wasn't even on. And at the time of turning your microphone, you actually still thought it was a good idea. Ancient Aliens is a show that's a fascinating show about, you know, the idea of influence of aliens on ancient cultures.
Right. I know.
Most of it is,
by the way, we should mention that the guy has – that one dude passed.
Philip Copens. Yeah, unfortunately, if you – it was only maybe 40 episodes ago we interviewed him, maybe less, Philip Copens, and really nice guy, and he passed recently. He's an author, and he's regularly on Ancient Aliens, and unfortunately he found out he had a very rare type of lung cancer, and within 1 year of finding out, or 1 month rather, finding out about it, he was dead.
Wow.
Yeah. Really scary stuff.
They thought it was like some kind of bacteria infection or something at first, and it couldn't...
It's apparently pretty rare, but a really nice guy, really unfortunate. And the first guy who ever died who did this podcast, right? That's the first one who's done the podcast, not with us anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah, crazy. Nice guy. Sucks. He wasn't even 40, I don't think. I think he was like 39 or something.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, shit.
Yeah, sorry.
I was imagining a guy in his 70s or...
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
But Ancient Aliens is it's a really fun show because it's, they go the what-if route most of the time. They get pretty deep. Like Giorgio Tsoukalos is one of the main guys, and he's a friend of the podcast. He's been on a few times, and he has his fucking big crazy hair. I don't know if you've ever seen him. He's pretty, you wouldn't see him if you're out there in Spain hanging out with those sophisticated people. But he will get into this, this part where he goes, is it possible, that Bigfoot is an alien? And they'll go deep into the, is it possible? And if you're high and you're watching that show and he goes, is it possible? And you're like, oh, my goodness, where are we going?
I'm thinking Bigfoot could be Neanderthal.
Well, they're pretty sure that if there ever was a Bigfoot, that it's an animal called Gigantopithecus that did exist. And it's, if you've ever seen the images of it, it's pretty fascinating because it was essentially exactly what everybody describes, and they describe a Sasquatch. And it lived in Asia. And humans came from Asia. We know when they did one of the ways they found this out was they did a test in the human genome because a guy who was a Mormon – devout Mormon was convinced that DNA testing could prove that the Mormon the Book of Mormon was actually in fact correct, and that human beings did come from Jerusalem, and that all these American Indians were the lost tribe of Jesus. So they did a DNA test on them, and they found, no, actually, most of them are from Siberia. Mm. They're a lot of what you're getting when you're getting American Indians is people that came across the Bering Strait.
Sure.
Well, coincidentally, that area of the country is the highest area incidence of Bigfoot sightings. The Pacific Northwest, the Alaska, that whole way down, that's the only play, not the only place in the country, but it's like that's where it really started. That's where people really started seeing these fucking things.
Right.
And that's where they would be. I mean, it really kind of makes, if there really was an undiscovered primate, it would be in the rainforest or the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
It's not outside the realm of possibility. In fact, even Jane Goodall's convinced. She actually said she was convinced that there's an undiscovered primate living there. She said there's too many people with the same story.
Yeah. No, I didn't know that.
They have sounds that these things have made. Well, I don't know. Maybe they existed and maybe they died off, but if there's a small amount of them, it's not impossible that they're alive. If you stop and think about, like, how rare it is that you see a bear or a mountain lion, and you fucking know there's thousands of those.
Yeah.
If there was, like, one area where an animal existed, well, there's a lot of areas in this country where, like, it's only the only place where you can find blank, you know.
Right.
It's really hard to find an alligator outside of Florida and, you know, the South area.
Yeah.
You know, you don't find alligators too often in Michigan.
Right.
You know, that's a condensed little area. Boom, there's where all the alligators are. This is where the climate's perfect for them.
Right.
It's not outside the realm of possibility. There's like a fucking crazy monkey that no one's ever found. It's most likely not the case. Likely people are full of shit.
The problem is they're so big, they'd be top predators, and it would be hard for there to be a sustainable population of them in that area.
It's true.
You know?
However, we don't know that they're carnivores. They easily could be eating plant matter, just like elephants are gigantic as well.
Yeah, I'd still worry about the viable genetic material.
Yeah.
You know,
how many of them? Right.
Yeah. I mean, you think about like deer. Like, let's say deer, they're so infrequent that you never see them.
Yeah.
Could they continue as a species? You know?
We had a Les Stroud from Survivor Man. What the fuck was that? We had Les Stroud from Survivor Man on, and he told us a story. He's had two Bigfoot sightings.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. What's fascinating about that guy is he's 100% legit. He's not full of shit at all.
Right.
And he didn't actually see it, but he was in his tent, and he heard something big walking through. He's in Alaska.
Yeah.
It's miles from nowhere, and it flew in on a plane. I mean, hours by plane from everywhere, you know? And he heard something bipedal walking through the woods, something really heavy. And then it was like 50 feet from his tent. It starts going, makes this crazy primate noise. And he struggles to, he scrambles to get his camera, and then it runs off. And so he doesn't know what the fuck it is, but he knows it was really heavy and it sounded like an ape. You know, it's not likely they haven't found these things.
Did he find any footprints or anything?
I don't think so. I think it was too cold.
Uh-huh.
An owl in a tree and some kind of land creature walking up to get the owl. The owl freaks out, flies away, and so does the animal.
Yeah, it could be, but it doesn't sound that loud, and it doesn't sound like an ape. You know, unless we're there, it's all bullshit. Who knows? He might have had some fucking mushroom that he found under a log and stripping
the whole
balls
thing
off.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's legit, but if you see the scientific depiction of a Gigantopithecus, pull that image up. There's one online where they have a reproduction of this thing, and it lived alongside humans for sure.
Right.
At the minimum 100,000 years ago, but it could have been alive more than that or sooner than that. They got bones of this thing in like a Chinese medicine shop was the first time they found them. And, like, some anthropologist had gotten a hold of these bones. Like, what the fuck is this from? And they apparently from there realized that there was it was a primate tooth, and it was a primate tooth that didn't fit with the known species.
Uh-huh.
And so that initiated the search for this animal.
Right.
But when you see the image of Gigantopithecus, it's essentially exactly what a Bigfoot is. It's an ape.
Now, where
does
the aquatic ape fit into all this?
The aquatic ape theory is the theory of, like, that's a Gigantopithecus.
Right.
I mean, that's a real animal.
Okay, and that's from how long ago?
Is absolutely 100,000 years.
Right.
More recently than that, it gets sketchy.
It's funny. It looks like an orangutan, but I can't imagine.
But stands up bipedal.
Yeah, right, because it's too heavy to swing from trees. Right?
Yeah, and it doesn't give a fuck. You know? Imagine how strong that thing would be.
Yeah.
If you stop and think about the fact that a 150-pound chimp is as strong as a 500-pound man, what is a 2,000-pound primate? What kind of strength is that? I mean, a gorilla can literally rip you apart like tissue paper.
Mm-hmm.
What can that thing do?
And blow its nose on
you. And stuff you up its ass in little pieces. That's what a gorilla can do. Just shred you down into little tampon-sized pieces and stuff you up its ass. This thing, as recently as 100,000 years ago. That's fact. But there's speculation that they may have lived much more recent than that. There's a lot of different I'm sure you know, there's a lot of different species where they thought it was extinct, and they found out that
One
coelacanth, that crazy fish with the legs,
right?
You know, it looks like a prehistoric fish.
Oh, right.
Has weird like extensions to its like fins.
Right. Some dude pulled one up from in the 40s or something.
They were like, oh, we thought these things were long dead.
Yeah.
But it's especially ridiculous when it comes to the ocean. There's so little of the ocean that we really have a firm grip on.
Yeah.
But they found the tooth in 1935. In a apothecary shop. It was a fossilized bone, and I guess they used them in traditional Chinese medicine. So they've been grinding up these fucking bones of this thing forever.
Chinese medicine.
It's hilarious. Chinese medicine
is
hilarious.
I mean, the tiger penises and the bear gallbladders. I mean,
what is that? Is that
the shit?
Is that just psychological shit?
I think
is that what they're doing?
Yeah,
they're
just giving themselves mass hysteria, placebo effect.
It's amazing.
There may be some effect in some things, but I mean, come on, a tiger penis isn't going to, you know, make you horny.
Well, yeah, it's
unless
just,
you think it will.
It's there's so much of that need for faith and belief in faith in the entire Chinese culture, especially in regards to martial arts.
Mm.
Like China has been around for, I mean, think about how long Chinese culture dates back that we understand. I mean, thousands and thousands of years, a very sophisticated culture.
Yeah.
They have the most dog shit martial arts in the world. Their martial arts are almost entirely useless.
Really?
Yeah. They have very few martial arts where there's, like, legitimate techniques that would work in a situation against a trained fighter.
Because it hasn't been adapted.
They're not good.
Right.
They're just, like, clunky, like real kung fu, like you're pretending to be like animals and shit like that.
Right.
That is not the way to fight. It doesn't work. You know, there's established like now because of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. There's very clear parameters of what is and isn't effective against the best fighters in the world. There's no kung fu in that. There's a guy named Roy Nelson that says he's a kung fu fighter, but really just knocks people out.
But isn't a lot of kung fu about fatal blows, like ripping your eyes out or taking your throat out?
That
you
shit
can't
doesn't
do
really work. You can poke people in the eyes, definitely. No doubt about it. You can't really rip someone's throat out. You can try. It's not going to go out. It's so hard to rip out a throat, you know? Like, to think that you're just going to go in there like a fucking Billy Jack movie or Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse.
Right.
You know, that guy's going to be punching you in the face while you're holding onto his neck. It's not that easy to just grab someone's neck and pull it out.
Right.
Then people would be doing that all the time.
Right.
It would be like the
kick
number one cause of death.
Rip the balls off?
That doesn't work either.
No?
You kick somebody in the balls, it hurts, but if they're filled up with adrenaline, they're going to still attack you.
Really?
The idea that you're going to debilitate someone by kicking him in the balls, if he's a pussy, but it can't survive.
Okay,
if someone's trying to kill you.
Can I just say, you kick me in the balls, I'm debilitated.
Well,
I've noticed that.
You would also never be an attacker where someone would have to kick
you
in the balls.
You'd have a better chance just tickling the person with a chance that he's that ticklish.
Yeah, man. A lot of people, I think, probably, if you were trying to tickle them, they would fucking freak the fuck out.
Yeah, if you're super ticklish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you super ticklish at all, sir?
No, he's not. Look at the size. This is the actual size of a Gigantopithecus in relationship to a man.
G. blackie is what they call it?
Gigantopithecus blackie is the actual full scientific name.
Okay.
Well, it's 1930 that they named this fucking thing, you know? Those dirty bitches.
Yeah.
You know,
Quentin Tarantino is going to be making a movie about this before.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
I saw that movie last night.
What'd you think?
It's a very good movie, man. I mean, it's the use of the word nigger is so prevalent in that movie. It's kind of preposterous at a certain point in time. You're like, okay, really? Like, did you have to say it this many times? But the reality is, have you thought about it? Like, that's probably how they communicated.
Well, that's what he says.
As authentic as it gets.
Right.
But that aside, it's a fucking great movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good
it's
time.
Really good.
Some really funny moments, too.
Like, he's a bad motherfucker.
Yeah.
He put almost every one of his movies. Yeah, Gigantopithecus Blackie. Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah.
You uncreative fuckheads from 1930.
Did you read in, I don't know if you remember in the book, we talk about drapetomania, which was the disease of black slaves who had the pathological desire not to be slaves anymore.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, it was a medical condition. They wrote about it in medical journals.
Wow.
Drapetomania.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah, you don't want to be free. You're suffering from drapetomania.
Isn't that incredible? You tweeted something today that I wanted to discuss with you. Is there such a thing as sex addiction?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
That was that an article you were tweeting?
Yeah. It's an article by Marty Klein, who's a sex therapist for 30-some years.
What does old Marty have to say?
Marty says no.
Really?
No, Marty says that's silly.
I could introduce him to some girl that I know, and he would change his mind immediately.
Yeah, but I mean, there's obviously psychological addictions.
Yeah, what he's saying is you know, there are addictive personality types, mm-hmm. and it's not about the gambling or about the, you know, whatever it is you're addicted to, the jerking off in front of your computer or whatever. It's about a certain personality or different personality types,
right,
that are highly susceptible to needing that sort of stimulation over and over and over again.
And it could be anything that they lock onto.
Yeah.
They could lock onto playing cards.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird thing with human beings where, again, I think we're going back to the reward systems that right. set us up when we were hunters and gatherers for being successful. And one of the things that got us to be successful is persistence.
Right.
This crazy laser beam persistence of chasing that animal and focusing on that animal and right. being fixated on acquiring that animal. But that can be like for aces. I need fucking four aces. Right. Fucking four aces. I got right. these four aces.
Right.
It's like that same intensity. It's sort of found this weird path where it's not being fulfilled mm. by modern everyday life of cubicle existence, you know, sitting there and checking your emails and waiting for the fucking clock to strike five so you can run away
yeah.
and have your few hours of freedom.
Yeah.
Because we're trapped in that sort of a lifestyle, all these reward systems are not being fulfilled and they're sort of manifesting themselves in other ways. How else can we get excitement?
Right.
How about we bet the house on something?
Right.
Okay, let's bet the house on something.
Right,
we got to
right.
fucking do something.
Yeah.
We need to fire this kiln up. We need
right.
to do something to get ourselves excited.
Yeah. Yeah. Edward Abbey, I think there's a quote from Edward Abbey in our book where he talks about how sexuality is the only part of modern life that remains somewhat undomesticated.
Hmm.
You know, that we're like monkeys in a cage. Like we just sit there jerking off because there's nothing else to do, you know?
Yeah, that is something with people. Like they'll start their day off by just finding something to jerk off to. Like that's every day. I mean, that's not a small amount of people. That's like a lot of people.
Like everyone between every man and between 15 and 20 or so.
And at one point in time, I mean, there's so much access now. It's like yeah. At one point in time, it was difficult to find something to masturbate to, but now, I mean. If you have a computer, I mean, I have friends that won't they'll have like a computer that doesn't have Wi-Fi, or the Wi-Fi they'll break it on the computer just so that they make sure that they never go online with it.
Mm.
Like they'll, you know, they take a chip out. I'm not telling you. If you have a spot in your house where you can't get Wi-Fi, go there and right there. Because
yeah.
otherwise, your fucking computer is right there. That's the portal to pussy. You can see it anytime you want. You just press in a couple, all of a sudden there's a girl blowing a guy. You're like, whoa.
Yeah.
It's like it's so prevalent. It's
yeah.
it's no one ever thought that was coming. You know, in the back in the day when I was in high school and you had to get magazines and
yeah.
you know, when VCR tapes came out, it was a shocker. But now it's yeah. on your phone.
Well, there's a book called The Erotic Engine that argues that every advance in communication technology, you know, back to the 1800s has come about because of the desire to see and broadcast pussy.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's all about the porn.
Another weird sort of offshoot of the constant technology progress. You know, that
right.
seems to...
That's leading us... Yeah. And that's exactly the model we were talking about earlier. It leads us in these steps always closer to what we think is going to give us pleasure or satisfaction or something. But in fact, it may be leading us further and further away from the things.
From true happiness.
Yeah, because
but then
it's so simple.
The idea is that we are evolving, much like society's evolving, and we need to sort of physically and mentally and emotionally catch up with the amount of progress that technology is making and fit into this new paradigm and find happiness within it that is achievable and reachable. And I think it is. I certainly think that if you give people enough, I think people inherently need, especially men, difficult tasks in their life. They need to work. I think work doesn't mean, you know, digging holes, but it means putting your effort to something and finding a result in that. And there's some sort of, that's how you become a man. That's how you become a human. That's how you learn how to sort of navigate your way through the world is by trials and tribulations of trying to achieve things or to accomplish things or to explore things, whether it's just your education, you know, delving into education and you become more, you know, more introspective because of that and more understanding of yourself and your sort of fitment in this strange world that we live in. But if you don't have that, if you don't have pursuits, like that's where damaged people come from. That's where a lot of what's fucked up in this world comes from, is that people that aren't being led in a way that's going to develop them, people that aren't being guided in some sort of a multi-step process for understanding and for figuring out who you are and figuring out how what's the best way to interact with people, what's the most harmonious way to live your life, what's the way that makes you and the people that you come in contact with the most happy. And that's who you are. It just takes a long time to figure out how to become that person.
Yeah.
And we live in this weird society now where everything is operating on this crazy amount of momentum.
Mm.
And you sort of just hop on the escalator and walk with it as it's going, and that's your life. And you very rarely have a chance to stop and calculate and formulate a game plan.
Yeah, you're right.
So much of our behavior, whether it's financial, whether it's governmental, or whether it's sexual, much of it is based on like these silly notions and momentum, the momentum of the people that set this whole system up way back, don't even exist anymore.
Yeah, and I see, again, we get back to numbers, because I start to think it's, I think less in terms of the people who set it up and run it, and more in terms of the internal logic of the thing itself, that the society is the organism and we live within the organism, right? Just like so many different bacteria and things live within us. And, you know, you think of yourself as an individual, as do I, but, you know, you've got the DNA from thousands of different organisms all necessary to your life. I start to think we're inside. It's almost like they, you know, when Romney said corporations are people. They're not people, but they're organisms. They're alive. They've got their own logic and their own needs, and they don't give a shit about us, right? They're about making profit, which requires destruction of natural resources. There's nothing within a corporation that gives a damn that it's destroying the planet, just like there's nothing within a pathogen that gives a damn that it's destroying its host.
But it needs us in order to fulfill its destiny. It needs our creativity in order to fulfill its destiny.
Yeah.
If you looked at technology as a life form itself, you would. I mean, we don't think of, when we think of parasites like the Toxoplasma parasite or any other sort of parasite that invades, we think of them in organic terms.
Right.
But if you looked at what technology is doing to people, it's like, wow, that's very parasitic.
Yeah.
And us to it as well. There's like this weird, you could call it symbiosis, but it's also parasitic because it's polluting everything while it's being created.
Right.
And it's altering behavior. You can make an argument that technology is bringing us closer together and technology is bridging boundaries of consciousness and spreading information in an impossible. You can also make an argument that it's separating people from human interaction.
Right.
And it's like favoring the ones and zeros and numbers over actual human social interaction.
That's what I'm saying, that the process favors, the process is designed to satisfy the needs of the macro organism, not the microorganisms within it. So human needs are not important in this process. The need of the corporation are what's important, you know? So that's why I think we're less and less happy. That's why I think we're civilized to death, because we're moving further and further away from the things that make life satisfying.
I agree with you. How do you feel about antidepressants?
I feel that they're like sort of like drapetomania. I think a lot of people are quote unquote depressed because they're unhappy, you know, as opposed to organic, you know, serotonin, you know, levels that are misaligned. I'm talking about people. I think people are fucking miserable. Of course they're miserable. Their lives are meaningless. They're, you know, we talk about the things that really make people happy. Number one on the list is living in a community of people who love you.
Yes.
That's the number one thing. That's what you mentioned earlier, you know, with the lottery winners and so on. And as society becomes ever more fragmented, and, you know, more Americans are living alone right now as a percentage of the population than ever before in our history. You know, that's demonstrated.
That's because so many people are annoying. Sometimes it's better to be alone. Just fucking watch whatever you want to watch, eat whatever you want, walk around naked. Who gives a fuck? Leave me alone. There's a lot of that, too.
But, you know, you're talking about how we get caught on the wheel, you know, and there's no time to get off. That's like the central insight of my life was when I felt that. I felt that momentum building. And I took a summer off college. I hitchhiked to Alaska.
Whoa.
And I got,
whoa.
Yeah, I did it twice, there and back twice.
Jesus Christ.
From New York to Alaska, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
What,
yeah.
What are the odds of you picking up a ride and going, hey, man, I'm going to Alaska? And the guy's like, holy shit, me too.
Hope we like each other. Hope we get along.
What's the longest ride you went on?
Oh, I can't remember. Probably, well, no, I can remember. It was from, you take the ferry up the Inside Passage, which is up the coast of Canada. And then the ferries don't go around to mainland Alaska because the water's just out of control. There's, I think it's called the Chugach Mountains there. So to drive, you have to go up the Alcan Highway through the Yukon and then go across horizontally to Fairbanks. I think that's like 1,200 kilometers or miles. I don't remember, but that would be the longest ride. A woman picked me and these two other guys up that I'd met and drove us all the way. It was like 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a crazy lady.
Great lady. She was in a VW camper van with two little kids.
What year was this?
This was, I think it was the second year, so it was 84.
Wow, how crazy was she? She just picked up a bunch of dudes, in a VW camper.
Well, she picked me up first because I had been with these two guys, and some guy picked us up down in the town. I think it was Skagway, in the town where the ferry docks. We were trying to hitch out, and some guy picked us up and drove us like 20 miles into the wilderness and dropped us off and said, watch out for the bears. He was just a dick.
So he just dropped you off like to be an asshole?
Just drove fuck you to with some us. Yeah, he was a local place. Guy, and he was like, yeah, fuck you guys. You know, I don't remember. This was a long time ago, obviously.
20 miles.
But he left
woods?
Us in the middle of nowhere, and the only cars that came by were coming off the ferry, right? Because there's no like road that went into this town. So so we were stuck there. And so I was like, all right, we set up our tents. We had food and shit. We were, you know, backpacking in Alaska. We were self-contained. So we camped out next to this river, and I had some acid. We tripped. These two guys had never tripped before in their lives.
So you just like, fuck it. We can't get a ride. Let's trip balls.
Well, what else are we going to do? We got to wait till Wednesday till the next ferry comes in, right? So we're there like, 3 days. So we tripped out. Very interesting. Anyway, wow. These guys, I had a lot of adventures with these guys. I went to prison with one of them later that summer.
Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah.
That's a nutty life.
Yeah. But anyway, so we decided nobody's going to pick up all three of us. So they walked up the road and let me get the – so we went out, waited for the cars, and zoom, 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 zoom. And finally, this woman stops, and I knew my buddies were right up around the corner. So as soon as I got in the van, I was like, oh, yeah, how you doing? That was great. Oh, man, I've been hanging out with these really cool guys. Oh, I met them, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then we come around the corner. I was like, oh, there they are. And she just sort of looked at me and smiled and pulled over. Okay. So the three of us drove all the way to Fairbanks. She sat in the back of the van with her kids, played with her kids. I had all these cassettes.
She had kids?
She had two little kids, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's so crazy.
She was great.
What a chance she took, huh?
Yeah, really.
Wow. A lady with her kids.
She was like, Baha'i.
Oh, what do you have, a van? Okay. Let me get in there, lady. Jesus.
She was nice.
Wow. Well, I'm glad it worked out and you guys weren't crazy. You didn't wind up dismembering her and the family in the woods.
Man, I had my lucky hitchhiking shirt on, you know.
That's a bold move to just go out there and hope to get a ride. What's the longest you stood out there with your thumb out?
A few days. I remember outside of Whitehorse. This was the year before I was with my friend Mike. We were outside of Whitehorse. We were there like two nights at least. We slept by the highway. And then weird, I swear this is true. The next day we get up, we walked up the highway a little bit, you know, got our tents set up and everything, you know, back in our backpack, and walk up the highway a little bit. And this is like tundra, right? I don't know if you've been to this part of the world, Yukon. It's just like flat, empty. It's Arctic desert, essentially. You know, there's scrub, whatever. And walk up a little bit, and we find on the side of the road a book that had been there for God knows how long. The pages were just like really tightly curled back from the spine, you know. It was like some sort of bizarre shellfish or something, and we sort of peeled it down, and it was a Bible.
Whoa.
So we lit it on fire, and we started dancing around this Bible, right? We're like, you know, just nuts, right? And this truck comes by, this pickup truck, and at first we were like, you know, someone with fire. And yeah, it's God, right? They back up to us, and it's these three guys. It's like a dude in his 50s from New Mexico or something, and his crazy-ass nephew, who was like 23, and his nephew's friend.
And they were just like, yahoo, like real, real bozo dudes. Like they were pissed off that everything was more expensive in Canada. They didn't understand the money thing, you know, that it was different dollars. They were pissed off that the Canadians wouldn't let them bring their guns through Canada. There's all this stuff. They picked us up anyway, put us in the back, stopped when we crossed back into Alaska, and they got out and kissed the ground to be back in America. So they picked us up when we burned the Bible.
Wow. Yeah. You channeled them.
I guess.
You channeled like one of the best examples of weirdness in America, like the super patriotic retards.
Exactly.
That's fascinating.
Gun-toting.
That was your vehicle to get over there.
They got us out. Yeah.
What a strange lifestyle it is to just fucking hitchhike places and not exactly know who's going to take you or what's going to happen.
It's kind of like hunting gathering, you know?
Not really. It's kind of like putting yourself in a metal box with a psycho. You don't, you know, you could take a wild guess and I mean, you could be okay. Yeah. You know, you might.
I met some psychos, a lot of psychos, a lot of like homosexual guys and a lot of Jesus freaks.
Like what happened? What's the craziest thing that happened while hitchhiking? Homosexuals first.
And then, I was getting life coached from
then
behind.
Jesus freaks.
Well, no, the homosexuals. I gotta say, the homosexuals were fine. They were, you know, they were lonely. They were lonely guys.
And they were hoping.
And they were hoping. And I guess a lot of dudes that you know, there's like a sort of a system, you know.
Yeah.
But like, hey, I'm not gay, you know. And at that time, my best friend was gay. I'm certainly comfortable around. You know, so it's just
did
like,
you bring your best friend over to blow him for the ride?
Yeah,
that'd be a good move.
Actually, he came to Alaska later that summer, but he flew up. He was a professor in the school.
Well, he shouldn't have to prostitute himself either just for a ride. I mean, you're either going to give him a ride or not.
Like, blow Jesus the pilot. Christ. Get a flight out of it anyway.
Yeah, just a ride? Really? It's not.
But I'll tell you, one of the more memorable hitchhiking things was I was coming back, and I was coming from Montreal down to New York. I had friends I wanted to see in New York, so I was coming down that highway that goes down through the Adirondack Mountains, you know, very desolate, kind of empty country. And I always had a knife in my right boot when I was hitchhiking. Just like you say, things can get really weird. And I figured, well, you know, at least I've got a knife and like stop the fucking car, right?
Right.
But it was under my jeans. And I had these army boots and I always had it in the boot under my jeans. So I'm out there, and this guy pulls over for me, and he's like crew cut, ex-military looking dude, you know, real fit, tattoos, the whole thing. And he's like, "Yeah, so where are you from? What are you doing?" And within 2 minutes of the conversation, he says, "So you like knives?" And he sort of says it in that, like he's not asking, he's noting. And I said, "Yeah, I like knives, I guess." And he said, "Yeah, I noticed you've got one under your boot there on the right." And I was like, oh, geez. And I'm sitting in the car. How's he notice I've got a knife in my boot, like on the other side of the car? He said, yeah, I noticed when I picked you up. And he said, I like knives too. And he reaches to his belt buckle and goes, shh, and pulls out a knife that was in his belt buckle. And now the knife is like right in front of my face. And I'm like, fuck, man, this could be really bad, you know?
Right.
And I'm looking at it and I said, this is a really nice knife. He said, yeah. And like he let me take the knife and hold it and like, oh yeah, wow, that's cool. That's in your buckle, huh? Like, yeah, and I've got another one here. And he pulls out another knife. By now I'm like, he's not going to kill me. He's just showing me his knives.
Right.
The guy was a prison guard at Attica.
Whoa.
He drove me all the way to New York. He was a prison guard. And the thing was, like, he's a trained, you know, he's trained to notice shit like a knife under your
right, to see the bulge.
And that, I mean, that made such an impression on me because at that point I stopped carrying a knife. First of all, because those dudes are pros and I'm an amateur.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing I want to do is escalate the situation.
Right.
And
right.
It just really made this like, you know, I think I'm getting away with something. No, there are people who know what to look for. They're always one step ahead of you. It's tough. Like getting I don't know if you've ever been interrogated by police. It's hard because they've done it 1,000 times, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a question once. Is that interrogated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yeah.
I got a question once because I knew a dude who knew a dude who killed somebody.
Mm.
It was a weird conversation because I had a conversation on the phone with him, and then the cops wanted to ask me about what I knew because they were listening to his phone calls. I was like, that was kind of interesting too. I was like, whoa, like they tapped his fucking phone. That's kind of crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Luckily, I didn't know shit, but it was a weird sort of a situation. Like what is it legal to know that a guy might have killed somebody? You know, yeah, like, what do you do? Are you supposed to go right to the cops with that? Like, if you don't know whether or not someone's full of shit or not,
right?
What are you supposed to do there?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're safe. But that insight that you get caught up in this momentum, what happened that year in Alaska, that first year, was my entire life plan changed. Because I was like on the track to go to grad school right away. I knew a guy who was at Oxford who had me all set up to go to Oxford, do a PhD in literature, which is what I was studying at that point. And, you know, just go right in and be a professor teaching literature at, you know, some college by the time I was 30 with tenure and all set up. And, you know, and I went up to Alaska and I met all these people who blew my mind, who were really kind and generous and smart and deep people who weren't intellectuals. Right, who had no idea who Nietzsche was or whatever. And my friends back in, you know, my sort of high IQ friends would have scoffed at these people. But in fact, they were happier. They had a better life than my miserable, arrogant professor friends. And it really made me think about where I was going in life. And I said, okay, so here's what I'm going to do. Until I'm 30, I'm not going to get on that wheel. I'm not going to go to grad school. I'm not going to get married. I'm not going to have a career. I'm just going to float around the world, do crazy shit, meet crazy people, think about what I want to do with my life. But don't start till after 30.
To give yourself an actual number.
Just to say at least till 30. Like no commitment. Your commitment is to not make a commitment until you're 30.
There's a lot of shows that are on the air lately about Alaska. There's these subsistence shows. Well, there's subsistence shows. So families just survive in Alaska, and they show how many different villages rely completely on nature.
Right.
And I'm obsessed with these shows. It's so fascinating to me. They're so compelling, this chase of food, you know, whether it's they're growing some food, they're collecting salmon out of the river, they're shooting animals and cutting them up and freezing them, and they're just everyone just goes nuts for 4 months. Stockpiles all the food and then waits, and then the whole thing freezes for 8 months. Yeah. It's really weird.
A lot of backgammon.
Yeah, I don't know what the fuck they do, but essentially they barely shower and clean themselves for 8 months.
Right.
They were talking about clothes, about like during the winter, like you barely wash your clothes.
Yeah,
because you can't.
Yeah,
things just freeze instantly. It's 40 below zero. How do you keep clothes wet? You know, what do? You go out, you put them out because they hang their clothes sort of outside to dry. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
You just step outside, it's frozen instantly.
Yeah.
There's a guy who lives in Alaska, and he's a queue maker, and he was on the phone with a friend of his, and he took a bucket of hot water, and it was so cold that he took a bucket of on the phone with him. He said, I'm gonna do this for you. I'll throw the water. This is how cold it is. He throws the hot water up in the air. Before it hits the ground, it's frozen. It was 90 below zero or something fucking crazy. Yeah.
See, if I have to be subsistence, I don't want to do it there.
Woo! But it's so glorious. Like when you see these people that are, you know, hunting caribou or hunting black bear, and you see the landscape that they're traveling on and how few people there are. One of them was this family that's related to the singer Jewel. Do you know the singer Jewel?
Yeah.
And her family.
Is this Iceland?
No. Well, her family, I think the family is originally from like Sweden or some shit, and then when Hitler was storming Europe, they decided to move to Alaska and start this subsistence living.
Oh,
and the
really?
Singer Jewel comes from this family.
No shit. Really?
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure. I hope it's not bullshit.
Wow.
But to watch the show where this family's like living on the same piece of land that their grandfather got in like the 1940s.
Right.
It's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting stuff. You know, they're just out there. They have cattle, and then the entire year is a collection run. It's just run around, collect hay, run around, collect animals, freeze them, collect fish. And they have nights where they don't have anything to eat. And then they have to get up in the morning and go trap rabbits. And, you know, it's like, whoa, like that is a nutty fucking way to live, man. But meanwhile, how much different is it than someone living check to check, you know, and being on the subway with a bunch of other crazy assholes or watching someone get pushed in front of the car, you know, the weirdness that we have to deal with in modern society.
Yeah, well, the fact is the stress level is much lower. I mean, Sapolsky, we were talking about earlier, one of his big points he makes about stress. He wrote a book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, which is a pretty good book. But he makes this big distinction between chronic stress and acute stress, right? And we're evolved to deal with acute stress, sleep, not eating one night, you know, mm-hmm. and there's no food, so you go out the next day and you deal with that. What we're not evolved to deal with is chronic stress, you know, sitting in traffic every day, you know, waking up to an alarm clock every morning, you know, all this, you know, on the subway every day or whatever it is, you know, that's we're not evolved to deal with that. That's what wipes us out and makes us crazy.
Cancer, all kinds of other shit. The kind of stress that we deal with on a regular basis, of the stress of not wanting to do something but having to do it all day and being not satisfying whatsoever.
Right. Yeah.
Like the process, what you were talking about earlier, the process of gathering food, creating food, growing food, and catching fish or whatever is very satisfying.
Right.
It's like it feels great.
Well, that's what we do for vacation.
Yeah.
Right.
We go
it's
fishing.
Like, that's how they live. We go fishing. We go hunting. You know. Yeah. We go hiking in the mountains. That's what they're doing day to day.
Yeah.
Of course they're fucking happy.
Yeah.
You know, there were these people on Darwin's boat. Do you know about this? I think I talked about it. We talked about it in Sex at Dawn. It was Jemmy York. And there were three adolescent Fuegians, Indians, that the captain of the Beagle had picked up on an earlier voyage, these kids. And he took them back to England so they could be educated in England and see the glory of English life and proper living properly and all that. And then on the voyage Darwin was on, they were taking them back to Tierra del Fuego, where they were going to teach their people like how to come out of the woods and live properly and all that. And so Darwin knew these people really well. And by the time they got there, they built them a cabin, they made a garden, they got them all set up, and they left them there and said, okay, we'll be back in 3 months. They took off and they were mapping the coast of South America. They came back 3 months later. The cabin was abandoned, the garden was completely grown over, and nobody was there. So they went looking for them, put out word they wanted to see them, and finally one of them came back and went out on the boat to have dinner with Darwin and the captain. And they were like, what happened? What's going on? He's like, man, he said, why should I farm? There are plenty birdies, plenty fishies. It's like, forget that farming shit, you know? Like, everything we taught you, you abandoned it in a couple of months to go back and live in the mountains, you know? Something that looks miserable to the British, right? But for the people who had experienced both sides, they were like, fuck that, man. Wearing these silly, uncomfortable shoes and clothes and digging in the dirt. There are plenty of fish and birds and stuff to eat.
Yeah, when you see farmers, you don't think like happy, good times, singing around the campfire. You
exactly.
think that stoic existence of rising in the morning and milking the cows and pushing the plows. And it looks like death, whereas like hunting and gathering is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's inherently enjoyable.
But
and why? Because that's how we evolve.
Yeah,
right?
But gardening is fun.
Gardening
is like you
fun.
Gotta
You're
find
right.
like there's a middle ground between gardening and being a farmer.
And there's something about having domesticated animals that's pretty nice too.
Sure, chickens and they have eggs every morning. They're super fresh. And if you've never had like fresh eggs, there really is a difference in the way they taste. Like an egg that comes right out of a chicken, you eat it that day. It's very delicious. If you could have chickens, that'd be, and you can kill those bitches and eat them too. If the shit hits the fan,
I'll tell you what, Casilda, my wife was raised in Mozambique, and she used to go out in the summers to her grandmother's farm, which is like rural Mozambique is rural, right? And they had a dog that was eaten by a tiger and shit. You know, it's like seriously rural. So one day, Cassie and I are in Amsterdam's. Beautiful spring day by a canal, and these ducks are paddling by. It's just like, you know, the Vermeer painting or something. And Cassie's looking at the ducks really intently. And I said, what are you thinking? She said, oh, I was just thinking how great it would be to grab that duck in the front and break its neck and gut it and pluck it and stuff it with garlic and peppers. And, you know, like she had this whole thing like the way her grandmother used to do, you know. Tell you, if the end comes, she's in charge of food. No problem.
It's funny how people will eat meat, but yet look at that in a very, as being a distasteful thing to think. As being an
like
uncivilized
me. Yeah,
thing to think.
I mean, I'm ashamed, but it's true. It would be hard for me to kill an animal.
Do you think that these ideas, have you ever considered that this is a part of what it is, sort of the natural progression from the ape that lives in the forest to being this sort of enlightened, aware thing with massive access to information, that somewhere along the line we must separate ourselves from the hunter-gatherer instincts and reward systems. And one of the ways to do that is with antidepressants and supermarkets, and that like it is a slow push away, and that we have to fulfill these weird needs in other ways, and that sort of facilitates the great machine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is essentially a struggle between the interests of the machine and the interests of the organisms that live within it. And so what I'm hoping, although I'm not that hopeful, but I'm hoping that at some point our intelligence allows us to consciously choose our own interests over the interests of the machine, right? I mean, it's what you were talking about earlier, developing sources of energy that don't destroy the planet, you know, developing ways to interact that is respectful of our individuality and you know, developing sexual mores that allow people to get pleasure in their lives. I mean, I was talking to a friend the other night who was going through a crisis, and he said, you know, it was Christmas Eve, right? So everyone's with their families. All his friends were sort of out of touch. He really didn't have anybody to hang out with, and he was going through a really hard time with a family member and stuff. He ended up in a strip club paying a woman $300 to hold him.
Whoa.
Right? That's the kind of world we're in. You know, it's... people are touch starved. Babies mm-hmm. are touch starved. A lot of masseurs will tell you it's not even about the massage. It's about being touched, mm-hmm. right? So I think at some point we have to recognize, like, wait a minute. This is going in one direction, but the things that actually make us happy are not out there. They're not in that direction. And the only way we can slow it down or stop it or even change direction, I think, is learning to have far fewer people on the planet. Because the more people there are, the more that wheel gets fueled and spins faster and faster. And the only way to slow it down is far fewer people.
Especially in other countries. I mean, the United States is probably the best country in the world, so we can keep our numbers very high. So keep having as many kids as you like. But China cut it out.
Especially you Mexican immigrants. Yeah.
That's a weird thing to say to people. People get very defensive when you talk about reducing the number of people on the planet.
Yeah, I'm not saying to kill anybody. You know,
I know, but there's no other way to do it. They can't live. If they can't live, someone's
going
to
kill them.
We're all
dying. We're all going to die.
Let them die
so,
off.
You know, attrition. We can let it go with attrition.
But what's going on with health and nutrition and science and medicine is like prolonging lifespans and stretching people out. Like,
yeah.
That's an interesting. What if it becomes infinite? I mean, there's talk, especially if you're in the Kurzweil camp, able to extend lifespan. Like Aubrey de Grey believes that within the next 100 years, you're going to be able to be 1,000 years old.
Yeah, but see, I think a lot of that thinking is based on faulty assumptions. Maybe not him in particular, but there's a section in Sex at Dawn where we talk about the longevity lie. You know, which is that most people think that human beings in prehistory, these ancestors we've been talking about, only, you know, lived to 35 or so. Somebody's 30 was an old person.
Well, Noah was 600.
He was an exception. I mean, we know he was exceptional, you know. So a lot of people are saying, well, hey, we've doubled the human lifespan. Why can't we continue to? But it hasn't doubled. The human lifespan is 60, 70, 75 years, even in the wild, rarely 75 years. But, you know, we're not going to – there's no evidence that the human lifespan has doubled ever. So this thinking that we can just keep, you know, increasing it isn't going to work.
What are you sending me, man? Sending me texts?
It was the lamp. It was for later.
Oh. I thought you were trying to tell me something, a secret message.
Yeah, me too. Like, get rid of this guest.
No.
Lose him.
How dare you? This is fascinating stuff, man. Do you think it is also possible that, as you know, I would not like to go back to being a monkey. I would not like to go back to picking cow patties up and looking for bugs to eat.
Right.
We have progressed to the point where we are now living in a civilized society, which I enjoy. I enjoy the internet. I enjoy television and restaurants. I enjoy cars. I enjoy going to the movies. I enjoy a lot of the aspects. So I don't necessarily buy the idea that no one is happy and that it's impossible to be happy in this environment. is it possible that it's just simply a matter of catch up and that we all must sort of morph and move on with the times, just as we have in going from being monkeys with no houses to people with houses to guys with cars.
Right.
I mean, that this is just a natural part of the progression of the universe, and the idea of hanging on to the past, this nostalgia for the simpler times, is really kind of silly.
Right.
And that even our notions about sexuality, our notions of communication and privacy, all of those are sort of ancient.
Right.
And they're only applicable to a world where the internet doesn't exist.
Right.
And as that this internet gets stronger and stronger and more pervasive, which it's obviously doing,
right,
it's going to eventually get to some point where it's ridiculous to think that you could ever live like the people in the taiga. You know?
I hear you, man. But that argument's very similar to saying, look, you know, the sort of holistic, the food you get at Whole Foods, people can't afford that, and a lot of it's bullshit anyway, even if it's labeled organic or whatever, free range, it's still da 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 da. So, you know, we should all just deal with it and eat at McDonald's because that's where we're going. Maybe there's a practical truth to that, but the problem is that just like the body, if you don't give the body the exercise patterns, the sleep, the nutritional content and so on, the, you know, fiber and all that it evolved to want, whatever you think about, whatever, however your identity or your sense of life has adapted, your body still won't respond to it correctly, right? You'll still get sick and die from it. So there's a level, I have a friend who's a cardiologist who says to me, I don't feel stress, right? I don't feel it. I was like, dude, you feel it. Even if you don't think you feel it, you still feel it. And I'm arguing about stress with a cardiologist, which isn't a good thing to do, but he's, you know.
Well, he has to. He's human.
That's the point. You know, I think even.
Just even traffic is stress.
Exactly. Well, and sticking a catheter up somebody's, you know, artery to fuck around with their heart, it's got to be stressful, you know?
Yeah, it's intensity, and that intensity is stressful. You know, it's like people, even great things, the idea of stress is always sort of, it has a negative connotation.
Right.
But it's stress,
positive
it's
stress.
Intensity. Yeah. It's like whether anything, if you're playing a video game, it's stressful.
Right.
I mean, it's your system is being taxed.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at all these graphics, you're moving around, that is stressful. It's not negative,
right,
but it's, you know, you're redlining shit, you know?
Yeah.
Your system is not necessarily set up.
So, I mean, to answer your question, I think that's a legitimate argument for sure and a legitimate critique of all this sort of thinking, but I do think that there's a part of the human organism that can't adapt anywhere near as fast as society's changing. So it'll always be stuck in the Pleistocene, and the only way to deal with it is to understand what that environment was like and try to adapt your life in important ways to bring it into sync with that way of life.
You know? I completely agree, and I don't mean to suggest in any way that people shouldn't sort of manage their consciousness in a more valuable way or in a more more applicable way. You know, what I'm saying is that when I look at the progression of the ape-like creatures that we must have been at one point in time to what we are today, I mean, what is it going to be like 1,000 years from now, 100,000 years from now, 1,000,000 years from now? We're obviously going to be something completely different. We're going to be if we exist in the same physical form, it's going to be very odd. It's going to be something is going to happen. And it really seems to be like a matter of trying to enjoy this thing that you're trapped in, this dimension that you're trapped in. And one of the ways inherently I think it's very important is to appreciate the physical. And because especially with people, I don't want to say intellectuals, but people that fancy themselves intellectuals more than true intellectuals, because a true intellectual will probably take into account all the different variables and understand that the body is your meat vehicle has to be tended to in the proper way in order for you to get the right feelings from it.
Right.
And part of your negative feelings with your mind has got to be connected to this thing that's carrying you around.
Right.
But I think that concentrating on that is thought as being a base thing, like a not important, it's so rudimentary, it's unnecessary, it's so so apish, you know. we don't really need to concentrate on that, but we really do.
Yeah.
Sexually, as far as the stress that you get from everyday life of input.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in the sensory deprivation tank. I have one in my basement, and I've been using them for years. And one of the best things about the sensory deprivation tank is that it offers you this environment where nothing's coming at you, like literally nothing,
right.
No sensory input at all. And it's so hard to achieve that anywhere else in the world. When you're in that tank, there's just nothing. You're floating through space, and you nothing's coming at you, and it's such a recharge.
Yeah.
It's so much better for me than sitting in front of the television for an hour or sitting on a couch, which are the nice things to do to relax. It's nice to sit back and just veg out for a little bit, but that environment is something that not enough people experience, the environment of the isolation tank.
Just you ever meet John Lilly?
No, he was gone before I found out about it all. Yeah. I think he died. I don't know when he died, actually, but...
Late 70s, maybe, early 80s. My friend Stanley knew him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Fascinating dude.
Yeah. You should meet Stanley sometime. Stanley knew everybody. Stanley was my professor in grad school, and we had breakfast together one day when I first started. And then later I got a note saying, you know, Dr. Krippner would like to meet you, you know, come to his office, whatever, and I go talk to him. And he's this sweet old guy, and he says, listen, you know, your life sounds pretty unanchored. You know, you've got a lot of freedom in your life. I'm going to Brazil in 2 months. Would you like to go with me? All expenses paid. You know, the people who are inviting me to Brazil will pay for my assistant to go, whatever. So, fuck yeah, let's go. So I went to Brazil with Stanley. And
for how long?
That was like 10 days or something.
Wow.
And now Stanley is one of the world's most renowned experts in things like telepathy, on altered states of consciousness, and shamanism, and dream interpretation, all this kind of freaky, deep stuff.
What's his first name?
Stanley Krippner, K-R-I-P-P-N-E-R.
Dude, let's get him. How can we get him?
Oh, he's super cool. No, you can. I'll have him come down.
Where does he live?
He's 80. He just turned 80. We were at his birthday party in Berkeley a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
Daniel Ellsberg was there, Stan Groff. I mean, Stanley tripped with Timothy Leary. He knew Alan Watts. You know, this whole, like, intellectual 60s, 70s, hippie intellectual scene, Stanley was the young guy. He was the, like, in-house psychologist for the Grateful Dead for years, hung out
with
them.
They had an in-house psychologist?
Well, he was, you know what he was? He was what you were talking about earlier, where, like, the prominent people would just have a smart guy hang around. That's what Stanley was.
Oh, that's awesome.
The smart guy.
How smart were the Grateful Dead? That's a brilliant move.
Yeah.
Have a dude like that around with you?
Yeah.
We need one of those, Brian. We need to get a super smart dude to come around with us.
We do. It's Joey Diaz.
For you, Joey Diaz represents the Oracle.
Yep.
He's the impossible knowledge that can never be achieved.
He's about to be a daddy today, I think.
Is it today?
Tonight.
Are they going to induce?
Wow.
He tweeted something today about, like, this is his last day of having no responsibilities or something like that.
Wow. Crazy. So, This book and the information that you put out from it, how has it been received? Have you I mean, it's obviously a very successful book, but what kind of criticism have you had to encounter with this?
It's been interesting. I would say the response has been 95% positive, which is not at all what we expected. We were expecting 50-50 at best. The negative criticism has been, I'm going to sound like an asshole saying this, but I think most of it has been pretty emotional. It hasn't been arguing the intellectual points made in the book. It's been just sort of freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the first reviews was by an economist named Megan McArdle, one of the first negative reviews. She reviewed it in her blog, and she just said, like, she first of all said it was written really poorly and blah, blah, blah. But then she said, human beings are not like bonobos. You know how I know this? And then in bold, because we're not like bonobos. That was her argument.
That's a silly argument.
Yeah.
That's a chick who's worried that her pussy's not that valuable.
Yeah. She had just recently been married, actually. Someone told me later.
Yeah. She probably was, like, totally clinging to the idea of monogamy. But, you know, you're not discounting the idea of a happy monogamous life in that book
at all.
What you're doing is just talking about the real history of human beings. And I didn't find it. I thought it was going, because I had heard the resistance about it. I thought it was going to be much more controversial than it was.
Yeah.
But not really much more. But I thought it was possible based on the reactions that I had heard from people. But I thought it was, you know, pretty factual.
Well, and we're not arguing, and this is a point I have to make in interviews all the time, we're not arguing that there's anything wrong with monogamy. Just like we're not arguing that there's anything wrong with vegetarianism, right? You can choose to be a vegetarian, and it can be smart and healthy and ethical and, you know, very good decision. But don't expect it to come naturally to you. Just because you've chosen to be a vegetarian doesn't mean bacon suddenly doesn't smell good anymore, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, understand you're going to have challenges if you take that path. It's an uphill path. And the reason it's an uphill path is because your ancestors lived like this, you know? So to me, there's no advice implicit in that. And we got a lot of pressure, actually, from publishers to make it like a self-help kind of book.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They were really into that.
Well, that's something we were talking about before we started recording, about dealing with people and dealing with publishers. Dealing with anybody who wants to sort of like direct your vision.
Right.
Of what, you know, ultimately your book is your art. I mean, this is your take on your work on this particular subject.
Yeah. But
someone will come along and say, you know what, it'd be more entertaining if you decided to make it a game show.
Yeah.
It's Sex at Dawn, the game show.
Yeah. Someone approached us recently who wanted to make an illustrated kids version.
Whoa, Jack.
Yeah, that's a challenge.
You might want to leave orgies out of that.
Yeah.
How do you do cartoon orgies, like SpongeBob SquarePants type dudes? No, please.
No, I was just going to say other reactions. Like one woman didn't believe Casilda really exists. That my publisher and I conspired to make up a female co-author to obscure the male, privileged, phallocentric, you know, perspective.
Oh, that's funny.
So there's been that sort of thing. We haven't gotten any response at all from, like, the Christian right, you know, who I was hoping would get really offended and freak out in loud voices, but there hasn't been a peep out of them.
There's a bit of intellectual bigotry involved in anything masculine. Like anything that is a masculine trait or masculine wants or needs or behavior patterns is almost rife for criticism, like right away, like automatically, intellectually dismissed.
Yeah,
you know, whether it's aggression or sexual needs or anything like that, automatically intellectually dismissed.
Do you know Neil Strauss?
For the name,
Who
is he?
He wrote a book called The Game.
Oh, yes. Okay, that's right.
Pick up artist thing.
Yeah.
I interviewed him on my podcast, and I said to him, like, what do you say to people who say you're just teaching losers how to manipulate women? You know? And he was like, yeah, interesting. You know, how much time do women spend learning how to manipulate men? Right? But
some do, but some don't. You know, some pride themselves in just being real. But
But the point is women are much better at dealing with relationships, let's say relationship skills, right? Mm. You've got the cosmetics industry, you've got all this cosmetic surgery, you've got, you know, the hairstyles and the fashion. That's all about attracting male attention,
right?
And holding male attention. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying women are using it to hurt men necessarily, but I'm saying there is a huge industry around helping women deal with men. And he was saying, like, the first time you start talking about helping men deal with women, it gets dismissed in the way you were saying.
It's true, but in my opinion, what he's doing is like horseshit.
Yeah.
It's a temporary fix. Like, really, what you need to do is be a bad motherfucker. Figure out a way to be a real man.
Yeah.
You know, be a real man. I always say, and this is a corny way of saying it, but it really works. Be the hero in your own story. If you were living a movie and you're the guy that everyone admires, and he woke up and this is his situation, how would he handle it? How would you handle each individual moment that you encounter in your life? Well, if you were the guy that you would look up to, how would you deal with it? Just do that shit.
Hitchhike to Alaska.
There you go.
That's what I do.
Do that shit.
Yeah, but see, not everyone can do that.
You say that, but I'm not sure if that's true.
Well,
I think that limiting sort of thinking is very dangerous, because who are you? Who am I? Am I the type of person that can do it, or am I the type of person that fails? And is there a difference between the two? And is the difference between the two focus and intensity, belief? What is it? Is it genetics? Is it circumstantial? What is it? I'm not exactly sure. So to say that not everybody can do that, I think everybody can do it.
I think
everybody can do their own thing.
But don't you think it's a mix of all those things?
Yes.
And some of those things are out of our control. You know, I mean, I feel very privileged. I grew up, I had unconditional love from my parents. They had enough money that I knew if I ever really got into trouble, they could bail me out, and they would. They'd sell their house. They'd do whatever to come save me, you know, when I overdosed or wrecked a motorcycle in Thailand or some stupid shit. So I felt free to do things that I think a lot of kids don't feel. You know, hey, you, one of your parents is dead. There's no money. You're helping. Right. You don't have the chance to say, hey, fuck it, I'm going to hitchhike to Alaska. You
right.
know? And I wrote an essay in Psychology Today a while ago. I remember when the Sikhs got shot recently in Wisconsin or wherever it was. And I was thinking about the first time I'd ever met a Sikh. It was, I'd been working in New York in the Diamond District, which is a whole crazy period of my life. But I quit that job and flew to New Delhi, one-way ticket to New Delhi. I wanted to go see the world, right? So I had about $15,000 in cash in my money belt because someone had told me that you got a better exchange on cash, $100 bills, than you did with traveler's checks. So I had all this cash, right? I was going to go travel till the cash ran out. I figured 2-3 years was my plan. So I land in New Delhi, I get this little room in Old Delhi near the train station, and every night I would sleep with my money belt under the pillow because someone had told, like, the locks on the doors are ridiculous, and somebody told me, like, watch out, people come in at night, you got to be really careful. So I had my money belt under my pillow, and I got this ticket to go to Kashmir, very early train. It was like a 40-hour train or something to Kashmir. And it left at 6 a.m. or something. So the night before, I packed up my backpack, got everything ready. So in the morning, all I had to do was wake up, brush my teeth, and go, right? So I did. I'm sitting in the train station, waiting, having a chai. It's, you know, almost 5:30 or something. The sun's coming up. It's already really hot. And this bead of sweat rolls down my spine. And I go to touch it. Where's my money belt? I left it under the pillow.
Oh, no.
This is like 5 days into my adventure. Chris is going to go see the world, you know, intrepid traveler, dude. All my money is in this fucking guest house near the train station. So I run with my backpack, run back to this thing, go up. There's the owner is awake by this point. And he's like, what are you doing? I just ran past him up to the door, banging on the door. People inside speaking Hindi. They won't open the door. I don't know what the fuck. I go down to the front desk and he's like, well, hey, what's happening with you? I said, I left something in my room. He said, what did you leave? I said, some papers. I need some papers I left there. He said, what kind of papers? My Indian accent sounds.
Right, right.
I felt like my passport. I left my passport. He said, oh my God, you left your passport in the room. Anything else? And he's looking at me like, there's this look like he's not unfriendly, this guy, but he's not stupid.
Right.
And he's looking at me in a way, and I feel like I'm being tested in a way.
Yes.
And when I've come to those moments in life, which I have several times, my instinct is just tell the fucking truth.
Right.
Just naked, you know, like naked. Don't try to play a game.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's like what I was saying about the knife in the boot. It's like, yeah, you're better off undefended in a way. And I said, I left all my money there. He said, all your money? How much money? I said, about $15,000. He said, do you know how much? $15,000. I said, yeah, about $15,000. He reaches under the table, hands me my money belt.
Oh, my God.
I look at it. I don't count the money, but there's a stack of hundreds in it.
Did you give him one?
He said, while I'm looking at it, he said, the boy who cleans your room found this. He makes about $7 in a month.
Jesus Christ. The kid needs a new job.
Yeah. So I took a couple hundreds out and I handed them to him. I said, please give them to him, to the boy, and to thank you. And he said, no, you'll offend him. You can't do that.
Wow.
So I said, well, what can I do? He said, you know, give me, I don't know what it was, $5-$10 or something, and I'll have a party to honor him among all the employees.
Wow.
And he says, now you go, get your train, and be careful with your money. And so I think back on that guy. I think that guy saved my life. Because I look at myself now as badass. I'm this adventurous guy. I went all over the world. I've done this. I've done that. And I always came out of it okay. And I've done – that guy could have put me on a completely different track where I'd be calling my parents, you know, collect a week after leaving the country to get – you know, borrow money for a flight back to their basement. That would have been a different life. So I guess what I'm saying to you is – not everyone's lucky. Not everyone.
I say yes and no. Because I say you're just basing your the whole chain of events on what would have happened if you didn't have that money. If you lost that money, you could have gone on an equal adventure, if not greater. It could have been more spiritually fulfilling because people actually helped you and you realized money's not important. You know, I can barter with my work and who knows? And, you know, your version of why you are willing to take chances in your life is based on a version of having a safety net.
Sure.
My version is the total opposite. I don't know my father. My mother had me when she was young. She worked all the time. No one was ever home, and I was raised by wolves. So I essentially figured my own path through life and rejected the normal notions of what you should and shouldn't do because I saw these people were miserable and I didn't want to be like them.
Right.
And so I think that water seeks its own level, and I think that curiosity in a person and, you know, a desire to see things and experience things, it's sort of it's a part of being a human, and it's whether or not that's nurtured, and whether it's nurtured because you're ignored and you develop on your own, or whether it's nurtured because you're loved and you're given the freedom to take chances. I think either or, it's like pursuit is what it's what's fascinating. Whether it's your life's pursuit or mine or anyone else's, where they find an interest and they study it or they chase it. They have an idea and they follow it.
Yeah,
you know, I think that what's most important in your story was that fucking cool guy, and that you can do that too, and that we can all like have these acts of kindness that sort of decades later you're still describing.
Know? It's, you know, I completely agree with what you're saying, and in my life I think it's important to have a sense of gratitude because it keeps my feet on the ground, and to keep reminding myself, like, you've been pretty fucking lucky. And you didn't do anything to deserve it. You just were, you know? And so when bad shit comes, don't forget about that.
Right.
Don't start feeling bad for yourself because, oh, now something bad happened. Well, you know, fuck you. You know, your bad account is very...
It's very weak.
Yeah. Deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, just living where you live, being Canadian, you know? Just living in America, living in a first world country, living in a country that has fresh water, you know, living in a place where, you know, you don't have to worry about these... armed gangs going through your town and shooting everybody for no reason, and no one even covering it in the news because there is no fucking news.
Right.
That's a big part of the world. You know, I always said that the apocalypse is here. It just moves real slow, and it's not everywhere. It hits spots.
Yeah.
And if you were in Liberia right now, you would think it's the apocalypse. You would think you're living in Mad Max times.
Yeah.
Dirt roads and rampant crimes and $1 prostitutes, and it's just chaos and murder and cannibalism. You would think that you're in the apocalypse because for them it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your idea is compelling that, you know, there's too many people, and I really wonder how that's going to be worked out, because that's the one – I feel like we can work out a lot of social things, because I feel like young people have access to information in a way that really was never possible for any generation prior. So I think if there's ever a time where the momentum is going to be at least slowed, altered, or stopped, now's that time.
I got to say, I felt really hopeless about – Western society until the last 4 or 5 years, and there's a glimmer of feeling like people really want change.
Yeah.
You know, and I think before now, wanting change that badly depended upon things going so far into the shithole that, you know, it's like revolutionary civil war kind of craziness, right? And now things are like tolerable materially. But I think there is what you were saying. There's something happening in the consciousness of young people. I mean, you look at what's happened with acceptance of same-sex marriage, for example. It's like a steamroller.
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, it was nothing. It was, you know, it was. It's like things are catching flame really quickly now.
Yeah, you're ridiculed if you have an issue with same-sex marriage now.
It's right. Like, exactly.
There's no argument for it.
And that's happened in 10 years. You know, I look at Dan Savage. You know Dan Savage. Yeah. He's a friend of mine, and because he basically is responsible for the success of our book, right? I mean, that's what did everything. That
what
launched
was his
it.
Did he have a book?
Oh, he's got lots of books. Yeah, he's got half a dozen books.
What is his famous one? I could get confused.
Well, I mean, he's a sex advice columnist.
Yeah,
you're not. And there's the Michael Savage, who's a right wing
crazy nut.
Yeah, no. This is Dan Savage. Dan Savage, you probably heard about. What he did to Rick Santorum.
What did he do?
You don't know about this?
No.
All right. So Rick Santorum said, so this is like 7 years ago or something. Rick Santorum says something about how
you know, if we allow homosexual marriage, next thing you know, men will be marrying dogs and, you know, trees and all this shit. So Dan Savage, who has a nationally syndicated sex advice column called Savage Love. It's the most read sex advice column in the country. It's in the Village Voice and the LA Weekly. It's like in the back, you know, every alternative, you know, and online, The Onion. He started with The Onion. He says, okay, we've got to, like, find a definition for Santorum. What is Santorum? So he asked his readers to send in crazy definitions for Santorum. And then he had a – people could vote. And the one that won was Santorum, that sometime, that frothy mix of lube and fecal matter that sometimes results from anal sex. And he sets up a web page and then has his readers bomb the web page. So if you Google, right now, Google Santorum, that's what you're going to get.
Wow.
So this guy's political career was done. Done. It was like the most brilliant, you know, information terrorism ever.
Well, Santorum's career was done more because he was found to be a liar.
He's nuts, yeah.
He's a nut. He's an anti-gay guy. And he also lied about his marathon running time.
Oh, no, that was...
Yeah, it was Rick Santorum. It was a guy running. Oh, no.
It was Paul Ryan. You're right. Paul Ryan. Yeah.
Santorum was just crazy anti-gay marriage guy.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's done. There's a faction of retards that are still alive in this country that, you know, will cling to these, like, simplest of values.
Yeah.
You know, they think some of the marriage is between a man and a woman. And like marriage is ridiculous, period, even for men and women. It's all stupid.
Yeah.
You know, why not let gay people do that stupid shit too?
That's what he says.
Yeah.
But why the hell did I raise him? That was in reference to
your friend
something.
Savage. Savage was...
Yeah, Dan Savage.
Guy who dates Winnie Cooper.
No. He's married to a guy named Terry, and they have a kid. Oh, why he was responsible for the book's success.
Yes. Is
that he just really pushed it. He read it and loved it, and then he, like, in his column, read by millions of people, he basically said, buy this book, you know.
Yeah, well, you were talking about the acceptance of gay marriage. And
oh, that's the point, right. So my point is that 10 years ago, Dan was radical. He was way out on the fringes, right? You know, he was writing this gay sex advice column that cracked everybody up. But now he's mainstream. Like, he's on the Colbert Report 5 times or something, you know. He had a profile in the New York Times. Dan hasn't changed at all. He hasn't changed the language he uses, the things he talks about, the political positions he takes. The stream has changed.
Yeah. I attribute that to the same thing, the information that people have access to now.
Yeah.
They can't just be as flavored by the ignorance of their local area as they used to be in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, right. 90s, whatever. When 2000s came along, people just had a completely new perspective. And we have to really take into account that that's a decade.
Yeah.
I mean, we're dealing with 2 decades of internet influence. Maybe a little bit more, but not really. Yeah. That's pretty much it. You go to like 92, 93, that's about the first evidence of the internet's interaction with our culture.
Yeah.
You've got mail. And it goes from that to what we've got now. And we're seeing like real changes. Look, Colorado and Washington State making marijuana legal.
Right.
And what the fuck is going to happen from there? And I think the federal government eventually is going to crumble under the crippling weight of the ridiculous way they run the system.
It's unbelievable.
It's so fucked up that people, even people that are doing it at a certain point in time, are going to be like, we're being ridiculous. Like, the information is all out there now. You can't keep running it like this and pretending that we're a democracy and pretending we're a representative government, all about freedom. This is fucking crazy corporate chaos. And it's got to settle down. And by the way, everyone's not happy. Like, you're making billions and you're still fucking miserable as shit.
Right.
Like, this method of control and financial, the acquisition of financial wealth, it's not satisfying for anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and it's certainly not the best way to have a harmonious nation, you know. And I think that's possible. I think if it's possible to have a great town and it's possible to have a great neighborhood, if it's possible to have a great block and a great group of people that you hang with, then it's possible to expand that out further and further. If everyone had a great community and all those great communities combined and all treated each other as equals and as fellow citizens in this experiment called life, if everyone had that same same idea, then a great neighborhood could be the whole world. I mean, it doesn't seem outside the realm of possibility if it exists in the micro. why can't it exist in the macro? Well, it seems like it should be able to. And the only thing that seems to hold it back is communication and information. So there's the language issue, there's the cultural issue, but there's the access to each other that's changing. And it's changing at such a crazy pace that I'm much more hopeful than I have ever been when I was younger. Mm. When I was younger, I looked at it, I'm like, this is a fucking nuclear war waiting to happen. This is craziness. This is all going to fall apart. But now I think that people understand the world in a way that's unprecedented.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's probably entirely due to the internet. Like right now, I'm working with some people to set up a website for the exploration of ethical non-monogamy. Right, so it's like it'll have a dating site component to it, but it's also just about a community, forming a community. And what we're trying to do is have it be an online community that'll also have regional meetings where you can meet people face to face, but that it'll be set up along the principles of a bonobo troop. So females will be respected and, you know, valued, and there won't be any, like, hassling of women, and, you know, especially women who are openly non-monogamous, which attracts some attention. But also, like, yeah, a lot of portion of the profits, if there are ever any profits, would go to bonobo sanctuaries in Congo. And
so you run like
projects.
A dating site based on bonobo monkeys where people get to act like monkeys.
Apes,
sorry.
Yeah, monkeys Chips. Have tails.
Yeah,
monkeys
right,
have
right.
tails.
Monkeys a better word.
Well, do you know about bonobos?
Yeah, sure.
You know, okay.
The only thing that they don't do is the mother doesn't fuck the son.
That's right.
That's it.
But that's probably the most important relationship.
It's fascinating, though, that the mother doesn't fuck the son, because that exists in humans. So we talk about bonobos being freaks. The one thing that they don't do, that shit's happening all over the South right now. This mom's fucking their kids, for sure. We got to get out of here. We're running. At 3 hours in, we turn into a pumpkin. Listen, man, that was a really fun conversation, and your book is amazing. I'm really enjoying it. It's called Sex at Dawn. The author is Dr. Christopher Ryan. Say it again. Dr. Christopher Ryan. And you can get this on Amazon, on Kindle. I have it on a Nook. You can buy the actual physical book if you're one of those fucking holdouts to a dark day when you needed paper. Do you read books or do you use like a Kindle?
Both.
Yeah. Kindles are the shit, man. Those and if you get Whisper, do you have the version of it on WhisperSync on Amazon where it's read by someone, don't you? Doesn't it exist?
What do you mean?
Do you know what WhisperSync is? WhisperSync is Amazon has the Kindle Fire, and they have Audible has a application for it where you read it as a book, right. And then when you get in your car, it syncs up to your smartphone, and a actor reads it as an audiobook companion.
Nice.
Like picks up right
where
you left off.
It's
brilliant. But anyway, the book is Sex at Dawn, and it's Chris Ryan, PhD, on Twitter, and please follow him. Please buy the book. It's fucking great. You'll enjoy the shit out of it. And if your wife hides it from you, you know your pussy whip, son. Okay, you know you got to put your foot down. You got to be a man. You got to get your shit together. You got to reclaim your ape heritage. Thank you very much, brother. It was really fun. Thank you very much. Thanks for supporting the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, and tuning in. And thanks for all the positive tweets and messages and Facebook pages and high fives out there in the great wide world of reality. And please follow us on Twitter, Redban, REDBAN. And you go to deskquad.tv if you want to pick up one of those super sweet Death Squad t-shirts with the psychedelic kitty cats strapped up with bombs. I don't understand what it means either, but they're just cool. Go get them. Thanks to onnit.com. Go to O-N-N-I-T. Use the code name Rogan and save yourself 10% off any and all supplements. And go buy Blade Slinger from Kerosene Games. And you can get it on the iPad for $2.99. All right, you dirty fucks. We'll be back tomorrow with Brian Callen and maybe an Ice House Chronicles as well. See ya, freaks. Love the shit out of you.